Hello everyone, and welcome to episode 15 of the Lookout Sir 40k podcast, a Warhammer 40,000 podcast produced, delivered, developed, created by three, if not more, friends. I don't want to discount other people that have appeared sporadically throughout the process, but at this moment in time, three friends in the form of Phil.
Hello.
Hello, Phil. How has the previous 2 weeks been for you since last we spoke?
Not too bad. I've done a fair bit of hobbying. Been making my assassins because I thought I would dust those off, and I've been converting them up.
I've heard they've got new rules, Phil. New rules for the assassins. They're sounding exciting.
They do. Spoilers for what's happening later, though.
I imagine the title of the video would have been the main spoiler for that. But obviously, or podcast audio. Obviously, let's not discount those people. In fact, the greater majority of people who listen to us audibly via Spotify, iTunes, and other podcast providers are available, I believe.
I'm sure they are.
Well, exactly. I mean, we should know. We're the ones in charge of making that happen. And I tell you, someone who isn't in charge of making anything happen, and that would be none other than the incredibly beautiful, intelligent, sexy man known as Joe. How you doing, Joe?
All right, I'm glad we're still sticking to the praise.
Well, good. I mean, after last time, Joe, I don't mean to kind of talk analytics with you, but that's the worst episode we've had ever.
Well, it's just the people don't know what they want. That's what it is.
Well, I do think the people know what they want, Joe. It's not you.
Yeah. It's not the Joe show.
Oh, it makes me a little bit sad, but I'll get over it, somehow.
I actually think it's more to do with the content than Joe's contribution specifically. I think, you know, let's not be unfair there. I don't think there was a particularly bumper episode last week, was it? Or not last week.
Are you saying people just don't like Tim then? Is that what you're saying?
Well, exactly. I mean, Tim is the common denominator. This episode doesn't have Tim. Will it perform better without him? Let's discover.
Wasn't his, the best episode was when Tim was on with his Tyranids.
Well, then it has to be you, Joe.
Ouch.
That's the only possible outcome. If it's not Tim's fault, then it's yours.
I shouldn't have said anything.
It can't be mine or Phil's fault, because, you know, we're just brilliant in every way imaginable.
Yes. Oh, clearly.
Well, of course. That's what we've all come to understand throughout this process. I'm incredibly arrogant. Phil is an exceptional individual. And you're the whipping boy. That's how it goes.
That's my life. It's become.
Oh, dear. But, Joe, we didn't really get into what you've been doing lately. What's been going on in Joe's realms?
I've done a Death Watch army, but technically, I want to say this now, I bought all my Death Watch stuff before they were cool. I just didn't get a chance to put them together. And then they were cool. And then by the time I turned up with my Death Watch, everyone is like, Joe, you're just a sheep.
I thought you weren't really interested in doing Death Watch, and then you saw that guy who played on the live stream at GT Heat 3 and beat Lawrence, and decided that you were going to model your life on his and try and get equally as buff but also as good with Death Watch as he did.
Well, I'd already got three Stark Collectings. They were sat on my pile of things to do at some point.
That's a lot of Stark Collecting boxes.
Yeah. And in the Stark Collecting boxes, you get three Vendreds and you get 10 Deathwatch Marines and Captain Artemis, who no one ever uses. They just take him and cut him into pieces and then use him as something entirely different.
He's such a cool model, though.
He is a cool model. It's just that he's just, for lack of a better word, a bit... His rules are just a bit meh.
Why has he become a bit meh? Is it because he's roughly the same points as a Watchmaster and nowhere near as good?
Yeah, pretty much.
And the Watchmaster isn't overly remarkable, is he? He's just better than... He's a Chapter Master, right?
Yeah, he just stands there and goes, reroll all your two hits. And he just stands there looking stoic And he's like, I want to go in and stab something. And you're like, no, because you make everything else better.
But I swear that after you spoke to the guy at GT Heat 3, he was playing Deathwatch. Admittedly, not exclusively Deathwatch. He had some Imperial Knights and some...
Yeah.
I can't remember anything.
Well, I spoke to him and I said, I've got this stuff. Can you give me any pointers? And he was like, Storm Shields and Storm Bolters. So I went out and I picked up 30 Storm Bolters.
There you go.
But I've got a few units left to build and paint for them, whilst slowly painting up stuff for my Chaos. Like getting a few units done, so when the big release comes out in a few weeks, I can just be like, oh, I've got some units already.
Look at that. There's Joe foreshadowing another potential spoiler topic for what's to come as well. Look at that. That's good work there, Joe.
I know, right? It's like a weird but not quite tedious link.
Well, indeed. I mean, it's fair to say that for this episode, the theme throughout is assassins and demons. That's really where we're going with this. So that's assassins
and demons.
I'm going to edit that so it sounds a little bit creepier in post-production. But that is the corresponding theme for this episode 15. So to that end, the topics that we will be discussing are, first and foremost, the new Assassin's Rules. So Phil has actually been lucky enough to get his hands on a copy of White Dwarf at the point of which we're recording this, which is Thursday the 28th of February. So being one of those, you know, stoic supporters of subscriptions and or White Dwarf in general, he has the skinny on everything that's going on with Assassins, and we'll talk about that because he's taken photos of the pages and shared them around, and now we all know, which is exciting. Isn't it right? Isn't that right, Phil?
And it comes in a shiny, shiny art cover. So, you know, the main assassin image from, what's it called? Execution Force?
Execution Force, yeah.
Yeah, it's basically that artwork as a full cover. I don't know. I'm sure you've seen pictures of it from other places where the subscription one basically has the logo as a spot varnish, which is like a sort of shiny transparency. So when you tilt it at a funny angle, it catches the light. And then there's no text on it whatsoever except the graphic. So that's really cool.
Did they give away that piece of artwork as part of the Execution Force box? I can't remember now if it came with that artwork.
Yeah, it would be, because at that time they were always doing, not necessarily pullouts, but at that time I think they were, little cardboard sheets with artwork in. I'm sure it would be in that one.
Yeah, no, because I just got mine for Urban Conquest and for, I can't remember what the last one was. I think it was Urban Conquest. Was the last one I got of those. I should really frame them. I got loads of them.
They tend to use them as like dividers between sort of the content and the sprues to protect the booklets and whatnot.
Lovely times. So we're going to kick off by talking about Assassins. Then we're going to move on to the Demon Engine, more specifically Warhammer Community Site's ongoing Rumor Engine / Demon Engine and what we feel about that. Seen a lot of people on the internet getting a little bit grumbly about it, so we're going to give our own opinions on how that seems to have been managed or how we think that whole process is going, and generally how excited we are for the new Chaos stuff, which should be super cool. And then, quite bizarrely, we are then going to combine the two topics of Assassins and Demons and do somewhat of a retrospective piece where we talk about the, I believe, either 3rd or 4th edition Demon Hunters Codex. So we're going to do a bit of a retrospective. Phil has read the Demon Hunters Codex from cover to cover, and he's desperate to talk about what he found. So we're going to share in his knowledge and understanding of Demon Hunters as they were, I believe it was 4th edition. I might just do a Google check and verify that while Phil elaborates on that bit for just a moment.
Oh, well, I'll give the reasons as to why I've got in my possession a copy of Codex Demon Hunters, which I got off of you, Dan, of all people. Basically, as I mentioned in a previous podcast, I'm doing a sort of a small inquisitional force to ally in with my Krieg. And last time I went round to Dan's, just before we went off to the Brawlentine Day Massacre tournament, I spotted this codex was lying around, sort of in your lounge of all places. And I was like, oh, can I borrow that? And you were like, go for it. So I read it, because it's a relatively smallish codex for in comparison to nowadays. And it's really good. It's basically, give you a brief overview, it's Inquisitors, Grey Knights, and Assassins. Hence the sort of tie-in.
So I just checked, Phil, and if the 40K Wikipedia page, or more specifically the wiki page, is anything to go by. It's a third edition codex, you'll be happy to hear.
Yeah.
There you go.
It's good. I assumed it would be one of the older ones rather than fourth edition.
I was on the fence because I couldn't quite remember whether it was a third edition or fourth edition book just based on my supposed release dates in my mind for the Grey Knight range that came in, I guess, judging by this, third edition. So there you go. Exciting times all round. Now let's get on with the show, shall we?
Supposed.
Beautiful. Joe, do you want to make the transitional noise, as is a nice treat for you?
Ooh.
Hello, everyone. Now, as was advertised, assuming you're actually listening to the start intro pieces and not just skipping to the actual content stuff. I mean, if you are, that's great as well. I imagine there would be some words that would have allowed you to understand that we were going to talk about Assassins and you clicked on that and ended up here. Anyway, I'm going off on a tangent. Let's talk about the new Assassins. So, as we said in the intro, again, why not listen to that? It's probably longer than it needed to be, but there's some interesting stuff in there. Anyway, as we said in the introduction, we're going to talk about the new Assassins, because the new White Dwarf, the new bigger, better, bolder version of White Dwarf that they're now working on, which, as far as I can tell, is the same as it always was, just they're now putting actually useful content in there in the form of rules and other kind of bits and pieces. But nonetheless, this stuff is coming into the new issue of White Dwarf that we'll be releasing on Saturday. But for all those lovely subscribers, like our boy Phil, it comes early. So how do you reckon we should do this, lads? Acknowledging that I already know how we're going to do this. I'm just trying to create a bit of a back and forth in the first instance so as people know that you're still here. Phil?
Oh, well, let's give them a bit of an overview. They've updated the assassin rules to be a bit more interesting, a bit better. There's some stats, so let's talk about them first, I guess. And then there's stratagems.
Ooh.
Ooh. Ooh. So let's talk about those at the end. Or do you want to talk about each assassin at a time and its corresponding stratagems, which just probably makes more sense?
I think that is the way that we will do it. Unless Joe thinks otherwise. Joe?
No, we'll stick with that one. Otherwise, it'll be madness.
That will be a formula for success. So, let's start by talking about the Vindicare Assassin. So the Vindicare Assassin has a movement of 7, a weapon skill and ballistic skill of 2+, a strength and toughness of 4, he has 5 wounds, 5 attacks, leadership 9, and a save of 6+. A Vindicare Assassin is a single model, armed with one Exodus pistol, sorry, I was going to say executioner pistol for some reason there, but Exodus pistol, one Exodus rifle, and blind grenades. It's a pretty good stat, pretty good profile across the board, wouldn't you say, gents?
Well, it hasn't changed at all.
So has it not? Has that always been his profile in the olden days?
Well, I could get my index and double check if you want. I'm pretty sure.
If you're going to make those bold claims, Phil, I expect you to have fact checked everything.
Well, in which case, I will go get it, and we can double check as we go through.
Well, wonderful, wonderful. Do I need to do a seamless transition while you go get it?
Oh yeah, if you want to.
Okay, we're doing a seamless transition now.
So the stats exactly the same as what they were before.
There you go. That took him about 5 minutes. For anyone listening at home, who lies. Well, me and Joe all the while were talking about all sorts of other exciting things. But nonetheless, for you, that was verification. So the stats remain the same. So let's talk through some of his weapons, if we will. So we have the Exodus pistol. As a pistol, it won't surprise you that it has a range of 12. It is pistol 1. And is strength 4, minus 3 AP, which is really strong, and D3 damage, which is also pretty solid. So, invulnerable saves cannot be taken against attacks made with this weapon. This weapon wounds infantry units on a 2+. So, already, you've got a pretty tasty little pistol there. Not that that's going to be the main event of this character, but the fact that if he does find himself in a fight and he does survive, he can still potentially shoot someone in the face rather than have to try and endure another round of combat with them in your corresponding phase, which is quite a cool little addition. Thoughts and feelings on the old pistol?
It sort of does what it says.
Yeah.
It's a non-event because you're never really ever going to find this guy in that sort of situation, but it's nice to know that he's got it.
Thing that is cool with it is that obviously you can fire both weapons at the same time and you can choose different targets. So if you do happen to have someone eking in close to you to try and sneak up on you, or you're just in a bit of a board where there's some enemies, you can always pop off a shot with your pistol.
Please explain to me how that works, Phil.
Well, every weapon gets fired, can't it?
Not if it's pistol or a grenade.
Is pistols different?
Pistols are different. If you nominate to fire with a pistol, you may only fire that pistol.
I thought that was just grenades.
Oh. No, grenades and pistol. The difference between a grenade and a pistol is that the pistol can be fired by anyone in the unit, i.e. if you've all got bolt pistols, you can all fire them. The grenade, you can only throw one grenade.
Oh.
But the pistol sacrifices all of the shots. So if you've got a Tech Dominus or Tech Priest Dominus for your Adeptus Mechanicus army, the default option for that, I believe, is a pistol and a heavy free gun or a heavy D3 gun. I can't remember the specifics, but there is a upgrade to that pistol to take it as a Assault 1 weapon that's like range 18, something or other. So yeah, if you update to that one, then the Tech Priest Dominus can fire both. But if he's got a pistol and his heavy weapon, he can only fire one or the other.
I guess I've never come across having to do that because all my guides that do have pistols don't have, like, las guns or whatever.
Yeah,
because you always swap them out. So it's a bit of a niche rule. Oh, but that's good to know, though.
Yeah, exactly. Joe.
Contextually, that's a bit weird, though, isn't it? I imagine it would be easier to shoot a large rifle or a heavy weapon and then shoot a pistol and simultaneously shoot with two massive guns.
Yeah, admittedly, but there aren't very many characters in the game that have multiple weapons of that type.
Yeah.
So I think the only stuff where it gets weird is like if you've got an Elder Ulltark on a jet bike, because then it can fire the Shuriken catapults and its Reaper launcher,
yeah,
or its fusion gun. Same for a Space Marine character on a jet on a bike can fire the two bolters and its melter gun, but it wouldn't also be able to fire its pistol. In some instances, you can have a stratagem like the Elysian stratagem, I think it is, that turns all your weapons into assault, which means that you can shoot your pistol, your las gun, and throw both a frag and crack grenade in a one-er, which is quite hilarious because they all become assault one. Or whatever they do. So that's always funny. But in most instances, a pistol is the only thing you can shoot if you choose to shoot it. And I do feel like we've probably spent way too much time talking about this absolutely pointless weapon, because you're never going to fire that pistol, because he's also got a rifle, an Exodus rifle, which is range 72, which is very healthy. Very rare that something is more than 72 inches away from you, unless you're playing a really, really, really big game of 40k, but how often do you find yourself doing that? It's heavy one, with a strength of 5, a AP of minus 3, and it does D3 damage. As with the pistol, it wounds infantry, specifically infantry, on a 2+. So if you're thinking of shooting farciers on jet bikes, or captains on bikes, or, I don't know, Necron lords on catacomb command barges, you will be wounding them on the strength of the weapon. And given that most of those things are strength 4 or toughness 4 or above, toughness 5, it does somewhat reduce the efficiency of this gun, when it concerns shooting characters that have changed their keyword to be bike or whatever the command barge turns your keyword into. But what do we think about that? It's pretty solid all in, right?
Yeah, but obviously its only downside is it's like heavy one. So you don't really want to, I want to say move and shoot, but then there might be a special rule that changes that if we get around to those.
Yeah. And then lastly, it's the blind grenade, range 12, grenade D6. This weapon does not inflict any damage, do not make any wound rolls. Instead, if a unit is hit by this blind grenade, subtract one from all hit rolls for attacks made by that unit until the end of the turn. Again, the way grenades are, you're probably rarely going to use this, but there may come some instances where you know this guy is on his last legs and you know that he's kind of done his job of killing off major characters, and you find yourself in a predicament where it's like, well, it's probably more useful just to lob a blind grenade at this target and hope that will keep something else alive in subsequent turns. So it's a bit of utility, which is no bad thing for sure.
Yeah.
So, in terms of abilities, he's got Execution Force, Independent Operative, Lightning Reflexes, which I can see here. It says I need to check page 94. Just scrolling through Phil's photos. Page 94. I'm going to assume that's this here. There we go. So, Execution Force is, so long as your warlord has the Imperium keyword, you can include this unit in your army as part of a Vanguard detachment, even if that detachment contains no HQ units. However, if you do so, that detachment command benefits are changed to none, unless that detachment contains exactly one of every type of assassin. So, it's kind of nice, I guess. Independent operative, this model can never have a warlord trait. During deployment, you can set this model up concealed instead of placing it on the battlefield. And then lastly, lightning reflexes is this model has a 4+ invulnerable save. What do we think about that, generally speaking?
Pretty good. Obviously the 4 invuln's nice.
Joe?
I say he's pretty solid. But I don't really see you infiltrating him though. Because you don't really want to lose that turn of shooting the first turn.
No, agreed. So let's talk about the abilities, because, you know, the war gear, the profile are good. But the thing that really sets this guy apart and makes him, you know, worth his points is the ability. So we've got Deadshot. This model can target a character, even if it's not the closest enemy unit. In addition, each time an unmodified wound roll of 6 is made for the attack with a ranged weapon by this model, the damage for that attack is D6. What do we think about that, first and foremost?
That is better than it was, because he has the potential of knocking out a character in a one-er if you're lucky.
Do you think this is better than the standard sniper rule for doing mortal wounds, though?
Yes, because
I appreciate what I actually probably should do. Let's establish this actually as probably a better format. Let me talk you through every ability, because I think a lot of this stuff synergizes actually, because obviously this Deadshot ability, when I actually talk about the mortal wound thing, we need to take Headshot into account, because that's where the mortal wounds come from actually. So let's disregard that for a moment. Let me just get through all of it, and then let's just talk about him in general terms. So he's got faultless aim. This model remains stationary in its previous. If this model remains stationary in its previous movement phase, it always hits on a 2+ when firing a ranged weapon, regardless of modifiers. Hit rolls of 6 are still required when firing Overwatch. So again, always hits on 2s as long as he's not moved. Headshot. After this model has made an attack with a ranged weapon, roll 1d6 if the model suffered damage from that attack but has not been slain. On a 3+. That model suffers one mortal wound, and if that model is not slain, you can roll one more d6. And then if you roll a 4+, he takes another mortal wound. But if he's not dead yet, roll another d6. And if you roll a 5+, he takes another mortal wound. But if he's not dead yet, roll another d6. And if you roll a 6, he takes another mortal wound. And then if he's not dead yet, well, you're out of dice rolls at that point. And obviously you were shooting at something massive. But nonetheless, that's quite a nice little addition. Spy mask. Enemy models do not gain the benefits of their of being in cover, basically. So you ignore cover saves when being shot by this guy. And you subtract one from hit rolls for attacks made with ranged weapons that target this model. If that model is in terrain, however, you subtract two. So he is pretty durable when you think about it. So, yeah, discuss.
He's definitely a lot better at killing, like, marine-level characters with one shot now. Because before, you'd have to run two or three Vindicator assassins to just kill a Space Marine captain. Now, if you roll a six and you do your D6 damage and you roll a four, then all you have to do is roll that four plus or the three plus, for instance, just to knock off that last wound with a mortal wound.
Yeah, because if you think about it, you're going to hit on a two, you're going to wound on a two if they're infantry, then you've got 1 in 6 chance of it doing D6 damage instead of D3. And then after that, assuming they fail their save, which I guess it's -3, so there's a good chance unless they've got an invun save. But then I'm pretty sure there's a stratagem which will stop that, maybe. We'd have to double check. But assuming they do fail their wounds, it's like you've got over a 50% chance of doing a mortal wound, and then you've got a 50% chance, and then you've got a slightly less than 50% chance. So you're going to do anywhere, on average, you'll do two wounds plus a mortal wound. So you'll do three wounds on average, I would have thought, quite easily.
Yeah, so I'm not sure there's one that, again, looking at this here, is there actually something that ignores invulnerable saves for this guy? Yes. Oh, actually, it's the weapons, isn't it? Didn't the weapons ignore it? No. Invulnerable saves can't be taken. Sorry, yes, there it is.
Yeah.
So it's not a stratagem, that's just what the guns give him. So he's ignoring invulnerable saves. He's ignoring cover. He's always hitting on twos, though he doesn't have any access to a reroll, other than, obviously, the stratagem. So you will be potentially storing up your reroll if you roll that one. But then I guess the issue is if you reroll that one to hit, you then still need to wound, which again, assuming you roll that two, great. But that still may not get the desired result because then you need to roll the 3+ to do the mortal wound. And I don't know. It's an interesting kind of, scalability of how that works in terms of, if you miss with this guy, is it actually worth re-rolling the one to hit against a fully healthy character on the basis that you can't re-roll any of the subsequent rolls? Because at that point, if you failed to hit and you re-rolled it to secure the hit, you may then still wound, but they then could potentially save on a 6+, or they could not die to the amount of damage you do, and then you're relying on the headshot ability where you need the 3+, but then you fail one of those all important rolls as it gets increasingly difficult. I don't know, that's the only interesting element to me, is how would you re-roll the one, and would that actually be efficient on average?
Well, there's a stratagem for 1 CP that allows you to shoot again with the Vindicare. So instead of re-rolling to hits, if you wanted, you could instead just shoot again. Although you're probably just better off doing both. So spending 1 CP to hit and then another CP to get a second shot if you really need to.
The second shot, though, so it has to be a different target, though.
Yes, sorry.
So if you do the second shot, you're not going to shoot the same guy. Because, funnily enough, good old Richie, was talking about taking three of these guys, and I was saying that I don't think it's a very worthwhile investment. I think one Vindicare Assassin is incredible, or I think it's solid. I don't necessarily know if I think it's incredible yet, but I think it's good. I think three of them are so inefficient that it's not worth taking three of them. I think one and maybe some other assassins and maybe some sniper scouts probably gives you a lot more flexibility and options than three of these guys. So I think my appraisal of it, in short, is what we have here is a drastically improved Vindicare Assassin from the Index. I do think there is merit in including one of these in your Imperial Army. I'm not completely convinced that I would go crazy and start trying to take loads of them, because once they've killed characters, what do? They can drop one thing a turn, so, you know.
And they're not particularly good at killing sort of non-infantry, so sort of monsters and bikes that you're saying. Mm. So they can do it, but it's tricky, basically.
Oh yeah, if you're trying to kill a swarm lord with this guy, you're wounding it on fives.
Yeah. So I'd say that this taking him as an alternative to taking sniper scouts is probably better. Because if you max out with too many sniper scouts and you take two Vindicare Assassins and stuff, and you come up against a Horde army, you are running out of shots very quickly. Whereas, as he's a character, he could just sit at the back of the board fairly unmolested, just chipping away at those like annoying buffing characters. And then once he's done his job, he can just bimble off and grab an objective or something.
But again, which characters, in all seriousness, do we think this guy can comfortably kill in a one-er?
Well, any Imperial Guard one, pretty easily. I'm more saying that they've got three wounds, so I mean, it's down to how well you can roll your D3 damage or your additional mortal wounds on top of that. So, statistically, you're probably going to kill him, but it's all down to averages, I guess.
Yeah. So I would feel confident saying he'll kill a Astra Militarum character without too much aggro. I think he'd probably do okay against some of the Mechanicus stuff, so you know, sorry, Joe.
I'd say something like Demon Heralds.
Demon Heralds, he definitely would have a very good time at killing. He'd be... Well, interestingly, he'd probably... It depends. See, this is the problem. Against Yavrain, for example, so against Yennari, I don't think he'd kill Yavrain, because Yavrain has always... Because you always take her as with the Warlord trait where you get the extra... where you ignore wounds on sixes. So she's always got that extra ability to ignore the damage that comes in. And she's got... I think she's got five wounds. Maybe six. I can't remember exactly. Because I don't really play Yennari, but, you know, I don't know. Well, he could definitely do a lot of damage to her, but I don't think he'd kill her. Not guaranteed.
Other assassins, so as we start seeing more of them, if they start popping up in the competitive scene, whoever goes first is just going to drop the other person's assassins first.
You say that, though, and this is the other issue I have, and I feel like, again, without wanting to linger too long on this guy... I think the other issue he's got is the best way to play him is to put him in your deployment zone at the start of the game, right? That's how you have to play him.
Yeah.
If someone does that, you know for a fact that that Vindicare Assassin is there, and you know for a fact that you're going to have to deal with him, so you would position your characters behind walls or somewhere where he's not going to get line of sight, because... His most effective option is to kill characters, but characters aren't actually particularly difficult things to hide. But then I suppose it's what the rest of your army is able to do to draw those characters out, because that's what you need. You need him to draw out these characters, because, or rather, you need your army to draw out these characters, because it's not hard to hide a commissar behind a wall, is it? You either know where that assassin is because they've deployed before you do, or you pretty much know where the assassin's going to go because there's always the optimal place with the most sort of, you know, visibility of the board. So, yeah.
The thing is, just that in itself is a powerful move. If you can cover the majority of, like, the middle of the board or the majority of objectives with your Vindicare, and you know someone's either going to get shot by them by playing the mission, or your character's going to have to hide out and effectively maybe be redundant for the game because it can't go where it needs to go. So you can sort of effectively screen those characters from engaging in the game in the way that they need to. Now, some might not be able to, like, don't need to do that. Like, you could have characters that are just going to provide a reroll one to tanks, so therefore I can just hide the character behind the tanks. And it's still doing its job, and the tanks still have line of sight to everything, and then the assassin can't do anything.
Yeah.
So that's the optimal way to play against the assassin, I think.
Well, I suppose as well, there is, and again, this is the general kind of assassin stratagem, which is the, you know, the operative request sanction, which is this stratagem costs 1 CP if you're playing it in match play, or 3 CP if you're playing it otherwise. You can only use this stratagem if your warlord has the Imperium keyword. Use this stratagem during your deployment. Add one assassin unit of your choice to your army. Remember that in match play you pay for the assassin. And they very cleverly made every assassin cost 85 points. So, bizarrely now, with that stratagem in play, I suppose there's always that threat. Because if you turn up to a game and your opponent in tournament play says, oh yeah, and I've got an assassin in reserve for 1 CP. And it's like, you don't need to actually, by the way that's written, declare which assassin it is until you deploy your army. And if you're deploying second, you have no idea what to expect. Because if you deployed like a horde type army, or deployed a bit forward facing, or you had a few whatever, you could bring out the Eversaur. And if you deploy your characters irresponsibly, you know, surprise Vindicare. And it's like, oh god, that wasn't what I wanted. So I think that's the really interesting element, is the fact that now, for the sake of 1 CP, Imperial armies have that kind of, you know, trump card almost, that they can turn up and go, what you got? Oh, great, cool, I'll take this one. And that's really exciting, actually, I think, as an option.
Yeah, that stratagem in itself is pretty huge, because it gives any army the flexibility to take any assassin, and also any number of assassins, because that's something you do sort of pre-game, sort of during deployment, which means you can use that stratagem as many times as you want as well. You've just got a pave of points in sort of reserve. So I guess it's, you've got to work out the optimum number of assassins you might want to take.
Yeah, which I imagine would be two.
Yeah.
I think, again, two CPs, 170 points worth of reserves.
That does mean that you have to own two of every assassin, though.
True. I think you're always going to take the Vindicare and something else, though, not to declare what I think is my favourite of them. I just think the Vindicare is the most universally useful in almost all scenarios. But I think, actually, really, I'd only ever do one assassin. But, you know, that's me.
Well, there's still one extra stratagem we haven't talked about, which is the turbo penetrator round.
Sorry, yes.
I'll read for it. It's, use a stratagem in your shooting phase after an attack made with the Exodus pistol or the rifle by the Vindicare Assassin. When it's from your army and it scores a hit against the target that is either a vehicle or a monster, do not make a wound roll for this attack. Instead, you inflict D3 mortal wounds on that target. If this stratagem has been used, then the headshot ability doesn't count. So obviously you can't combo it with even more mortal wounds. But this, again, is 1 CP and is a useful thing if you, like saying, if you run out of characters or they just don't have any in your army, you can then go, well, okay, doing pretty much guaranteed D3 mortal wounds on a vehicle or a monster is pretty handy.
Absolutely. I mean, how many times have you found that Imperial Knight with one wound left that needs to be killed?
Say, can that be comboed with the shoot twice stratagem? So, like they do with Space Marines and the Armorium Cherub and the Heavy Bolter Stratagem that shoots D3 mortal wounds. Could he then potentially do 2 D3 mortal wounds to a vehicle?
I would assume not, because it says... but it's a bit vague. So it says, use this stratagem in your shooting phase. It does say then, after an attack has been made. So the assumption is it only works on that attack. But then it does say, after an attack with the pistol or rifle by an assassin from your army scores a hit against a target that is either a vehicle or a monster, do not make a wound roll for that attack. Instead, that hit inflicts D3 mortal wounds. I would assume not, but I could see people arguing it either way.
Well, I suppose that's the shoot twice strategy, and you have to shoot at something entirely different anyway.
Yeah.
So, I reckon we've probably talked enough about the old Vindicare there. Let's move on to the second of the glorious assassins. And rather than having me prattle on the whole way through, maybe Phil would like to read about the Kaladas.
Okay, I can sort of shorthand it in a way, because it is, stat-wise, it is the same as it was before. So movement 7, weapon skill, ballistic skill 2, strength and toughness 4, wounds 5, attacks 5, leadership 9, and a 6-up save. Again, it's got the independent operative and lightning reflexes and the execution force, so it's still getting its 4-up invuln. Then it's got 3 special rules, which I think has changed ever so slightly, but not by a huge amount. So polymorph is during deployment. This is the same one. You can set up your model in reserve, and then you can, when you're basically coming in from deep strike, you can, rather than being your normal 9 inches away, it's D6 plus 3. So that way you can be a lot closer. So you're much more likely to guarantee a charge against them. Then you've got hit and run, that this model can fall back and still shoot and charge in the same turn, which is kind of handy, I guess, if you want to like fall back, shoot, and then recharge someone or charge someone different. And then lastly, you've got Reign of Confusion, which is probably its best ability, which is if you have any models with this ability in your army, then your opponents during the first round... wants to use a command point, you basically roll a d6 and on a 4-up, that stratagem costs 1 extra command point. And it only works for the first battle round, not during like deployment, for example. And then a quick overview of the weapons. So it's got the Neural Shedder, which is 9 inches, assault 1, roll 3d6 each time this weapon scores a hit. If you roll equal to or greater than the target unit's highest leadership characteristic, it suffers D3 mortal wounds. So rolling 3d6, you're more likely to beat someone's leadership. So you've got a good chance of doing D3 mortal wounds on that unit. You've got the Phase Sword, which is a melee weapon. Strength user, minus 3 AP, 2 damage. Invulnerable saves can't be taken against this weapon. Then you've also got Poison Blades, which is strength as an asterisk, AP minus 1, damage 1. Each time the bearer fights, it can make 1 additional attack with this weapon. The weapon wounds on a 3+, unless it's targeting a vehicle, in which case it wounds on a 6+. So I guess this one's a lot better at killing monsters, because it's always wounding on a 3+. And then it's got quite a good, interesting mechanic for its Neural Shredder. Shall I quickly go through the stratagems now for it, just so we've got them all to look at when we're discussing?
Yeah, go on.
Yeah.
So it's the Kaladas. So it's got acrobatic for 1 CP. Use a stratagem in your movement phase. Choose 1 Kaladas assassin from your army. That army can advance and charge this turn. In addition, until the start of the next battle round, subtract 1 from hit rolls for attacks that target the chosen model. You've then got Supreme Deception for 2 CP. Use a stratagem at the start of any battle round after the first. Choose 1 Kaladas assassin from your army. That model's Reign of Confusion ability is considered to be in effect until the end of the battle round. You can only use a stratagem once per battle. So basically, you can't have multiple Kaladas's using that stratagem for several turns. And I think this is probably the biggest ability that it's got in the game.
Yeah, I think that is hugely beneficial in terms of how all that works with her. I think my opinion is of the Calidus Assassin is that she is especially good at killing Elder or Elder-themed infantry characters. The last thing a Yavrain wants to see in your army is a Calidus Assassin because, one, she can muck up your stratagems in the opening turn. So if anyone's out there running Samhan, Yanari bikes, all of a sudden their ability to, you know, move and, advance and charge has been potentially made more expensive. Now, admittedly, the cost premium that you're going to suffer there isn't going to necessarily stop you from doing it, but it's nice to have something that can punish you ever so slightly for that very, very powerful ability. And then, additionally, she's just a monster when it comes... Not a monster, but she is well-suited to killing toughness-free creatures or characters with a invulnerable save, such as Farseers, Yavrain, Warlocks, Spirit Seers. Some of the Gene Stealer cult probably aren't going to overly appreciate her either, although they can use all their weird shenanigans to have people throw themselves in front of those attacks. But I think, yeah, the Elder guys will definitely feel the sting of the Calidus, in my opinion.
Those poison blades could do some serious work to something like a shield captain as well.
They're only one damage, though.
I'm not sure why you would want to take the poison blades over the face sword, other than the fact that you get one additional attack. I mean, the only good thing is against higher toughness units, because it will always wound them on a free up. That's it. But then it's only minus one and one damage.
If you find yourself in a fight with, you know, horde units like Orc Boys or something of that nature, being able to wound on freeze is enough of a buff, but she doesn't dish out enough attacks. If she finds herself in a fight with a horde of Orc Boys, she's done for. The thing she does well is kill. She's a witch hunter, as far as I'm concerned. She goes out there and she's really good at killing things like Elder, Farseers, Zone Thropes, Necron Lords. I don't think Necron Lords would have a particularly fun time with her either. Trying to think of anything else that would really, really not like having her run into them. I think...
Yeah, like Toughness 3 is her optimal target, because she'd be doing 5 attacks, hitting on 2s, then wounding on 3s.
Yeah.
And then it's minus 3 to their save, no invulnerable save, and then 2 damage apiece. it's for higher toughness stuff is where she's struggling.
Yeah, agreed.
Having her on the table against Dark Elder and like a Castellan Knight army would be super useful, because anything like Agents of Vex turn 1 and turn 2 is costing 4 CP to get off.
It already costs 4 CP to get off.
It costs 5 CP. Then a Castellan...
Potentially costs 5 CP.
Yeah, and a Castellan, when it rotates its iron shields, costs 2. So, you're going to...
Well, no, Castellan isn't rotate iron shields free for a Castellan.
Then it's free only, now, is it?
Yeah, it's free, and then it's 1 CP for a normal knight.
Wow.
So then that's 4. Yeah, so it will really... Just having her on the board will really harm a knight army. Because potentially for 2 turns, you're going to make all their precious stratagems cost even more.
Savage.
Yeah, and I think, you know, the thing is with her is she's got viability in certain instances. I think the problem is with her is the fact that, obviously, she's most efficient when she's arriving from Deep Strike. Or being put into reserve, and arriving in turn 2 from reserves. But the problem is with that is that it does mean you've still got to suck up a turn of people doing the buffs and those kind of things. Also, as well, in a lot of these armies where these small buffing characters are going around, these toughness free characters, certainly like all Tarks and Farseers, if they do happen to be on foot, it's going to be very rare that you're going to find yourself in a situation when those guys are isolated in such a way as that she can get stuck in, I suppose. So as much as she would hand it to Yvrain, for example, from the Yanari army, she will very rarely be able to do anything about actually get stuck in to her.
Yeah. And then when she turns up on the table as well, that like those Eldar jet bikes with their 30 shooting attacks are going to shoot at her.
Yes, yeah, yeah. Well, assuming the Farseers are in range as well, because you know the Farseers are forewarned, but yeah, or you're going to all-spec scan her as soon as she comes down. There's things you can do against her arriving, because the thing is, she is somewhat of a one-trick pony in the fact that she's there to murder a specific type of character. That being said, she's not actually a one-trick pony, because she's got the disruptive effect of her...
The Reign of Confusion.
Yeah, Reign of Confusion. So, I mean, this is the thing. I like her. She's very situational. Love the model. Think it's a great model. Again, it's just one of those things. I think it's good, but you're not always going to want to use the Kaladas. I think the Kaladas... Me and Joe played in a doubles tournament where we took three assassins. We took two Eversaurs and a Kaladas. And I'll be honest, we both agreed at the end of it we shouldn't have bothered with the Kaladas. She did nothing valuable the whole tournament. Would you agree, Joe?
I would wholeheartedly agree. I like her and I like the idea of her. And I'm on these people that when I find a unit that I like, I want them to be good and I use them and try and make them good.
Mm.
But after running her over in five games over 2 days and she doesn't really do much, it's really difficult to argue the case. And those five armies that we played were all varied and different, so we can't even argue that we've played against three of the same army.
I think the thing is, and again obviously caveating heavily, that the army when we used her, before the stratagems and before the other things have come into effect. But I think, she's fine. I think she's good. She's situational. I think if you are up against a Yanari army, having your Yanari opponent be concerned about the fact that Yvrain could get beaten up really, really quickly, which she will do, then that's not a bad thing. But beyond that very specific situation, I just, she's very situational, great model. Really, really love all the Reign of Confusion stuff, and the hit and run stuff is also really cool. But again, I'd say, we'll rank them at the end, but I think she's fine, is my verdict on that one. Joe, do you want to tell us about the Kaluxus Assassin?
I can do. And for the Kaluxus Assassin, very similar to the other assassins, he's got movement 7, weapon skill, ballistic skill 2, strength and toughness 4, 5 wounds, 4 attacks, leadership 9, save 6 plus.
So he has one less attack than the Vindicare and the Kaladas. Kaladas.
Yeah. But he's still got lightning fast reflexes, or the lightning reflexes, independent operative and execution force. So he's got the Animus Speculum, which is 18-inch range, Assault D3, Strength 5, minus 4, 1 damage. Change the weapon's type to Assault D6, whilst there are enemy Psykers within 18 inches of the bearer, which is pretty solid. And then Psych Out Grenades, which is range 6 inches, Grenade D3, Strength 2, 1 damage. Each hit roll of a 6+ for an attack made with this weapon inflicts one mortal wound on the target instead of the normal damage. If the target is against... Hang on.
It does all wounds against demons and psychers, is what you're trying to say.
Yeah.
if you're on 60.
I'm reading on a really tiny phone screen and it went a bit blurry. So what does he do besides shoot lasers at psychers? He's got the abomination rule. This model can never be targeted or affected by psychic powers in any way. Psychers that are within 18 inches must subtract 2 from the psychic test and deny the witch test they take, which is really good considering the rash of Eldar players, the stain on the gaming community. Because hopefully knock them down a peg.
It's worth highlighting as well, though, that this ability affects both yours and your opponent's psychers.
I know.
That was the thing that was changed, because before it was only your opponent's.
Yeah. And then he's got life drain. Saving throws cannot be made for attacks made with melee weapons by the model unless they are invulnerable saving throws. So, unlike the previous two assassins who ignore invulnerable saves, you can still take these. And then he's got the rule Ethereum. Attacks that target this model are resolved if the attacking model had a weapon skill and ballistic skill of 6+. And then he's got Psychic Assassin. Attacks made by this model can target a character that is a psyker, even if they are not the closest enemy unit. In addition, this model can make an attack with its psych-out grenade in the same phase that it uses its Animus Speculum. So he's that rare unit that can throw a grenade and shoot at the same time, as long as it's a character. Well, psyker.
And he had a really weird question to ask, and I'd probably need to consult the rulebook because it's... Well, it happens often enough, but very rarely do you have an ability like life drain in play. So if you're attacking in combat, but you don't actually have a melee weapon, what is that?
They clarified it in the FAQ where everyone has a close combat weapon for free, basically, which is strength user, AP 0, damage 1.
Gotcha. So that's clarified as a melee weapon, right?
Yeah. So that is what every unit has by default.
Fine.
But normally, everyone normally has one. But it's only quite a rare instance where it's not specified on the datasheet.
Yeah, it's just interesting, isn't it? Because obviously they specifically call out him attacking with a melee weapon, and he doesn't actually have one.
Yeah, it's pretty random. And it's a bit weird, because then you've got 4 attacks... you hit on 2s, you've got strength 4, so, you know, you're wounding things on 3s, 4s, or 5s, depending on how good they are.
Mm.
They don't get a save, but they've got an invun, so a character's probably going to have a 4 or 5 up invun, maybe.
Yeah.
I mean, he's not that good at killing things in close combat. The thing he's really good at, though, is not dying, because anything needs to hit him on a 6, which is really good.
And his stratagems are quite interesting as well. I mean, Joe, do you want to go through the stratagems quick?
Yeah, there's one stratagem I want. Have we gone over the priority threat neutralize stratagem?
We have not gone over the priority threat neutralize stratagem.
It's the 1CP universal officios assassin aurum stratagem.
Yep.
It's used as stratagem after an enemy character has been slain by an assassin unit from your army. You gain 2 command points. Or 3 command points if the character was your opponent's warlord. You can only use this stratagem once for each enemy character model slain. Which is pretty good. Instead of you just bomb around doing over guard characters a turn, you're going to be racking back your command points quite efficiently.
Yeah, no, spend 1 to make 2, so that's quite nice. Strange that they didn't make it an ability and reduce the number of CPs, but I guess that would have been more powerful than spending the CPs, I guess.
A Vindica Assassin has the potential to kill 2 characters a turn.
But you can obviously only use this once in the shooting phase and then once in the fight phase.
Oh, yes, there you go, Joe. Take that with your silliness.
Okay.
But the interesting question is, how does this work with Is it beta rules still in terms of how you regain points, how you regain CP via abilities and stratagems? Because I got a feeling things like, sort of, say, Korov's Aquila only worked now once per battle round, not per phase or per turn. And I think some things like stratagems where you kill something and you gain a CP is excluded from that, but it's a specific list that they say.
It's so, almost like they should have never have given exceptions to that rule and just let it be one CP per battle round or phase. And it's exactly what we said, or I said, when we talked through the big FAQ. I have no idea why they've started adding exceptions, because then the problem becomes now when they forget that they even put exceptions in, because they probably have. And they look at this stuff and then they go, oh yeah, sorry, we forgot to mention this is an exception. In the same way as everyone's getting all a bit sort of weird about Gene Stealer cult ambush going into the shadows or burying underground, and whether or not they then can arrive up from reserves in turn one because of some weird exception that they've managed to convince themselves is true. And, you know, it's that kind of thing where it's like, oh, for God's sakes, like, just be consistent. Just be like, no, it's the same across the board. Sorry to, you know, people who have taken Trajan Valores, but that exception no longer stands. It's just one, it's one CP. That's how it is. Because if you're going to do it, make it consistent. Because, again, it's another one of those conversations where you've got to kind of chat to the person you're playing against and be like, sorry, what? Oh, is that an exception, is it? Okay, if you say so. And then you find out during the next game, oh, wait, it was an exception. He just got a bunch of extra CPs for nothing, if that happens, which I imagine it has done. But yeah, I mean, my assumption would be that this still is held back by the... Oh, actually, no, you're right, because it's weird, isn't it? Because actually, so you would spend one CP, but with the way that rule interacts with you, you would get only one CP back. So you'd spend one to get one, because you couldn't get two.
I think you still get two when it says it's two, but you can then only do that once per battle round.
Ten.
Well, yeah, but then there's other instances where they say it's only one, even though it could be two, except for the exceptions. And this isn't listed as an exception, therefore...
Not yet.
Until it is, you only get one.
FAQ'd, yeah, I guess we'd have to double-check the ruling. But either way, so even if... So assuming you pay one CP and you get two back, which is how it's intended to be played, it basically means that if you're taking these guys via the operative requisition sanctioned stratagem, so you just pay the reinforcement points and bring them on at the beginning of the game, it basically means they pay for themselves, because they're probably going to kill one or two characters a game.
You'd hope so.
So you'll get your CPs back, in theory.
So on the topic of other stratagems and CPs and all that stuff, shall we just briefly touch on our man, the Caluxus's abilities?
Yeah, so he's got the Prior's Gaze stratagem, which is one CP. Use a stratagem in your shooting phase before choosing a Caluxus assassin to shoot with. Till the end of the phase, the damage characteristic of that model's ranged weapons is increased to D3. Which is pretty good. Like, if you want to deal with, like, a high wound psyker, like, you can... do that. So if you come up against... I'd probably say, like, Demon Princes are a good candidate for this.
He still only wounds Demon Princes on... Demon Princes are toughness 5, aren't they, actually?
They are, so he's wounding them on 4s.
Yeah.
If
what if it's a Khorne Demon Prince? If it's a Khorne Demon Prince, you're stuffed.
Yeah. but then, like, if you're coming up against psychers that have some kind of, like, disgusting resilience, and you want to guarantee that kill, knowing that they're going to get loads and loads of saves anyway.
He's pretty
good, that one. And then the other one, which is Soul Horror, which is 2 command points.
Yep.
Use a stratagem at the start of your fight phase. Choose one Caluxus assassin from your army enemy units within 3 inches of that model cannot be chosen to fight this phase until all other units have done so, even if they have charged. If one of those units has an ability that allows them to fight first this phase, they instead fight in this phase as if they do not have that ability. So, if they have an ability that allows them to strike first, they lose it.
Which is fine if this guy could do anything in combat. I think it's that weird thing, isn't it? It's like,
yeah,
this guy's going last now. The only thing that makes that useful is if you've synergized it with something else that needed to go first.
Yeah.
But
like if he stood next to Gilliman and someone big charged Gilliman.
He's a good defensive counter for something that you really want to keep alive. So even though his sort of denying psychic stuff only works on the caster, not the recipient of it. So for example, something like Smite Spam, where you've got like a hemlock that's going to just fly across the board and do its psychic powers, then this can effectively stand in front of whatever it is and defend against it. But also likewise, if someone's going to get charged in combat that is going to get taken out straight away because they've charged, then this is going to stop that from happening. So this guy's got almost better defensive capabilities for something else and for himself than it has actually killing stuff, with the exception of psychers.
I suppose the only other weird thing is, though, is then how does that work with the counter-offensive stratagem? Because the wording on that's quite specific, that they fight next, and you've paid 2 yeah. CP, so does that trump this?
I don't know. I guess so.
I'd say it does.
Yeah.
But admittedly, you've still got to pay 2 CPs for the privilege, so...
Yeah.
Mm.
And again, you're talking about a really weird series of events here, right? Because you're going to have a Kaluxus assassin who's been charged, and there's something else, I assume, that then heroically intervenes from your army.
Yeah.
So maybe you've got an Imperial Knight that heroically intervenes 6 inches, or you're playing Space Wolves and you've heroically intervened 6 inches, or whatever happened. You may have heroically intervened 3 inches, who knows? But... So you've assumed this series of events has occurred, and then you've used the stratagem to lock them out of fighting before the thing that heroically intervened and your Kaluxus fought. But the thing that heroically intervened can't be targeted unless he was declared as a target anyway. So even in this instance, that's utterly pointless. I just don't... First of all, I don't understand why it's 2 CPs. Second of all, I don't understand why you'd ever use it. It's pointless.
It feels like it's a pretty niche thing. Although saying that, if you come down next to a psyker and you don't kill it, and the psyker is going to be a bit ballsy and charge you,
I don't think that would ever happen. You just get gunned down, wouldn't you?
Well, the thing is, they only hit you on sixes, though. So I think the thing is, you probably don't need this to survive unless you're against like a big horde of like orcs or something. They're just going to kill you with numbers.
Yeah,
because it's not like you can go first and then fall back in any way. Obviously, you can consolidate, but you can't consolidate out of combat.
No.
All right, so yeah, you're right. It's a bit of an odd one. I think it only really works if somebody charges you and, say, Gilliman, for example, and it's going to definitely kill Gilliman, and then you use this to keep it alive and allow Gilliman to go first to kill the thing.
Yeah. But that means he'd have to start in your lines, and then he becomes a weird defensive psyker.
Yeah.
And an aggressive psyker. So I suppose if you're up against Eldar or like another fast-moving force that's going to be up in your grill, I suppose orcs are a good example because they can... to jump straight up into your lines and then charge you. So if he's somewhere near the front, then he can like slow down the orcs, allowing you to get punching.
But again, right, the orc unit charges him, he uses the stratagem, he does little or nothing in response because he goes, aha, you can't take saves against this, but then the orcs go, cool, you did one wound, because four attacks hitting on twos.
The orcs are going to be multi-charging your lines anyway to lock up as much as possible, so it allows all your other units to get a hit in before they get absolutely mashed.
Yeah, but again, what you're talking about there is what the orc player will probably do, just declare an attack against the assassin and then overcharge into everything else, because the orc doesn't care about fighting, it just cares about wrapping you up and stopping you from doing anything in the corresponding turn. So unless you've got loads of stuff at the fly keyword and you don't want to get shot with loads of Overwatch, you just go, cool, charge the assassin, consolidate into the rest of your army, and I'm out. You know, it's that thing where it's like, great. And then you go, ha-ha, you can't attack till second. And it goes, great, I don't care. And okay, fair enough. In that example, I suppose, as you were saying, the rest of the stuff that the orc player didn't declare a charge against would get attacked before the orc had the chance to kill the Kaluxus, but in the reality of that situation, the Kaluxus would be... even if you didn't do that, the Kaluxus would just be dead, and you'd still get to attack, because the Kaluxus isn't doing anything valuable in that fight. So, yeah, I just don't get it. It's one of those ones where it's like, if someone can explain to me what I'm missing, then I'll admit that I'm an idiot, and that I'm, you know, obviously not noticing something incredible, but based on this, the Kaluxus assassin, I just don't get him anymore. I don't know what they've done to him. I don't want what could have made him better, but they've done a fabulous job of making him terrible. Like this, I don't get him at all anymore.
Yeah.
And he's a beautiful model, so I'm slightly hurt by that, but that's how it goes.
I think what they probably needed to make it done is that 12, that 18-inch bubble probably needs to work against powers as well, so powers going off onto targets within that. So I don't know if that's how Sisters of Silence work, or if they just can't be targeted.
They just can't be targeted. I think they've basically got the same rule.
So if he had a bubble that said no psychic power can be cast on any unit from or within this 18 inches, or maybe say 6 or 12, then that becomes a really powerful defensive model that you can have in your army to keep some of your key units alive.
Yeah.
I think the trick with the Kaluxus Assassin when it was early 8th edition was that you put them in front of your army so as you couldn't get smite spammed, because you had to target the closest thing. But now I think because characters can't block even smite, I think, anymore. Or maybe they can.
They can't. Well,
they just can't block other characters.
Okay.
From shooting, though.
So he still has that function, I suppose. Just put him at if you're up against Thousand Suns, put him at the or whatever. Put him at the front of your army and go, ha ha, smite's worthless. So Magnus doesn't want to see one of these, I guess.
Yeah, but then Thousand Suns can fill 10-man squads of flamers, so they'll just auto hit him off the table.
True, but then I suppose they're not super efficient against anything other than the Kaluxus Assassin. It's like, at last, burn! But, But there you go. I don't know. I need to be convinced on the Kaluxus Assassin. I don't get him at the moment. But closing out the roundup for the Assassins, an Assassin, I guess.
Yep, we missed out. Oh, no. Carry on.
Well...
You confused me, then I thought you were finishing it, and I was like, hang on, we've missed one out.
We have missed one out. That was my whole thing I was about to talk about. Weirdly, we're missing an assassin who probably doesn't deserve the name assassin anymore, because he's about as much an assassin as a wrecking ball is an assassin. I mean, obviously, if you point him in the direction of a character, he will probably kill it, but I don't think anyone is going to be using the Eversaur assassin to kill characters. I think the Eversaur Assassin has one very clear purpose, and that's to run into hordes of things and make them all die. So, if I can just talk through this guy, he's got a movement of 7, 2+2+ on weapon skill, ballistic skill, strength and toughness 4, 6 wounds, 6 attacks, leadership 9, and all the usual abilities of Execution Force, Independent Operative, and Lightning Reflexes, giving him a 4-up invulnerable save. He's got the Executioner Pistol, which is a range 12, pistol 4, strength 4, minus 1, 1 damage weapon that can re-roll wounds against infantry. He's got the Neuro Gauntlet, which is a melee weapon, which hits on a 2+ because of his weapon skill, has plus 1 strength, minus 1 AP, and you can re-roll wounds with this weapon, which is incredible. He also has a Power Sword, which is an additional minus 3, or rather has a minus 3 AP, as are all Power Swords, but doesn't have any other super awesome shenanigans. And he's also armed with Melter Bombs, which again is range 4, grenade 1, strength 8, minus 4, D6, and you roll wound rolls for attacks made with this weapon that target vehicle. Sorry, you re-roll wound rolls. In terms of his abilities, he's got Bio Meltdown. If this model is reduced to 0 wounds, roll a d6 for each enemy unit within 6 of this model before removing it from the battlefield. On a 4+, that unit suffers d3 mortal wounds. He's got the Sentinel Array. Each time an enemy unit falls back whilst within one of this model can immediately make shooting attacks against them, as if it were the shooting phase. He's frenzied or frenzen. What the heck does that say? Anyone want to take a stab at that one? Frenzen.
Frenzon. I think it's like his kind of chemical stimulants, I guess.
Ah, there you go. There you go. Not the friend
future.
Yeah, not the friend zone.
Well, he's putting everyone in the friend zone.
He's putting them in the friend zone permanently. when making a charge roll with this model, roll 3d6 rather than 2d6. In addition, add 2 to this model's attack characteristics if it charged in the preceding charge phase, making his attack characteristic 8. Noting that he rolls 3d6 for the charge, but as far as I'm aware, he still needs to be within 12 to assault.
Correct.
Lovely. Yeah. And then Killing Rampage. That was an easy word to say. Each time an enemy model is slain as a result of an attack made with a melee weapon by this model can immediately make one additional attack against the same unit. These additional attacks cannot themselves generate more attacks. In addition, this model can consolidate up to 6 inches instead of 3. And we'll just close out because we'll quickly talk about his abilities because we may as well get it all out in the open before we talk about this guy. So he's got Stim Overload, which is use this stratagem at the end of the fight phase. Choose one Eversaur Assassin from your army to fight with, that model has already fought in this phase. Sorry, choose one Eversaur Assassin, and he basically fights again. It's at the end of the fight phase, so obviously you have to take into consideration that he will get swung back at if he's charged into a big horde of things. But this is pretty impressive all the same. You have to roll a d6, though, so on a 1, 2, or 3, it will suffer 1 mortal wound. So, obviously, if a unit of Orc Boys has taken him down to 1 wound, and you want to do this ability, you're relying on not rolling a 1, 2, or 3, because he'll just drop dead on the spot, which wouldn't be fantastic fun for you.
Well, it wouldn't be too bad, because you do it after you've fought, and then if you kill him, he then gets his Bio Meltdown.
Mm.
Which does even more mortal wounds.
Yeah, but then 2 CPs to murder him.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
On the spot is probably a bit much. So that stratagem is 2 CPs, and rightly so. Most other characters have to pay 3 CP for that ability.
Isn't that normally to fight, like, immediately?
No, those are always end of fight phase.
Oh, okay.
So, well, at least to the best of my understanding, most of them are. The Blood Angels one definitely is end of fight phase. But there you go. So there's that one. And then the second one is his 1 CP stratagem called Hyper Metabolicism. Anyone else want to try a stab at that old Hyper Metabolicism?
Hyper Metabolism.
Yep, something along those lines.
Metabolism.
Metabolism, that's it. Yeah, God, we're all doing it wrong.
Oh my God, my dyslexia came in strong there, didn't it? Hyper Metabolism is a much better word than Hyper Metabolicism.
Well, that's what we have to call it from now on.
Yeah, exactly. Hold on. Hyper Metabolicism has come into effect. Jesus, I'm sorry, everyone, for my terrible, terrible mispronunciation there. But nonetheless, Hyper Metabolicism, or Hyper Metabolism, as Joe's correctly said. I think the problem is when you look at 40k words, your brain switches off from normal words and you just sort of think, oh, yeah, it's going to be something ridiculous. Anyway, Use this stratagem at the start of any phase. Choose one Evisor Assassin from your army. Until the end of that phase, roll 1d6 each time that model loses a wound. On a 4+, the wound is not lost. Really strong. I mean...
Oh, excluding mortal wounds, it says.
Excluding mortal wounds, obviously, yeah. Sorry, caveat that. So, what do we think of the Evisor Assassins, guys? I won't give my thoughts straight away, although I think it's pretty obvious what I think of him.
Well, I personally love him, and he's always been my favourite assassin. And like you said, no one's ever going to use him to kill characters. Like, you're going to... Playing against a guard, orc, tau player, like someone that runs, like, pretty shonky, like, shield units, he's just going to turn up, shoot a couple, or shoot another squad, charge in, and just murder the entire squad. So if he's hitting a guardsman, a cultist, an orc, or a tau fire warrior, he's going to hit 7 out of those 8 attacks.
He doesn't have any re-rolls, but you could comfortably estimate he'll get 7 out of 8 on Maths Hammer, if you will.
Yeah. I will say 6, then.
I reckon 7. Let's be generous to our boy, the Eversaw.
Yeah. 7. And then you use the Neuro Gauntlet. So we strength 5, wounding... Well, no, use that. He's strength 5. He wounds everything on 3s anyway.
Yeah, again, if you're talking about most horde units, they've only got 5 and 6 up saves, right? So you don't need the -3 of the power sword.
So he's wounding all those on 3s, re-rolling. Mm-hmm. So let's assume that he's wounding 6 times out of those 7 because you roll a shonky re-roll.
Yep.
And then he's going to kill 5 of those. He then gets to make 5 additional attacks on top to finish off the unit. And if he doesn't kill that unit, they're just going to disappear to morale.
Unless, of course, you pay CPs or use a wall or trait or do whatever you do to stop it from happening.
To save 2 or 3.
A lot of people do, actually.
Especially if they're on an objective, for example.
Yeah. But the fact is that this guy can get stuck in to, again, if we use the Orc Boys example, when someone takes a 30-man mob of Orc Boys, this guy can run in and kill probably as many... Well, he'll kill anywhere between 8 and 10 Orc Boys when he charges into it. And obviously that's not a humongous number against 30, but it's enough that you've made a significant dent. Then in retaliation, obviously those Orc Boys are going to probably chop him to pieces. But then he blows up and does an additional D3 mortal wounds if you roll the 4+ for that unit. The other thing that's super interesting about him, I suppose, as well, is because he's got the pistol. The pistol will potentially drop another 1 or 2 Orc Boys as well. So you could comfortably say this guy will drop between 9 or 11, maybe even 12 Orc Boys.
Yeah.
If he survives the combat with the 4, basically against Orc Boys, it would be a 4+ invuln with a reroll, because you can use the 1 CP stratagem and then use the feel no pain as a reroll, and you've got 6 wounds. You could potentially live, but in all honesty, the chances are very, very slim. But if you did it and fought again, you could get another 8 or 9 dead orcs. And all of a sudden you're talking about having killed 20 Orc Boys with 1 dude for 85 points, which is really solid. In all honesty, the likelihood of this guy surviving the returning attack is negligible. But he does blow up as he goes away, and he will have left them needing to take quite a severe leadership test. Although, again, mob rule would probably mean they pass it anyway. But if you can get to the sweet spot with them and kill maybe 15 of them in a turn, it starts to look really bad for him at that point, I would say.
He is a prime candidate for running 2 assassins as well. Right, if you're going to run 2 of the same assassin, you're going to take 2 of these.
Yeah, maybe. I think this is probably the prime candidate. I think if it were me, I'd probably take him and a Vindicare. Pretty consistently.
But the thing is, though, two of these can turn up and just kill whatever's blocking that character, and then the rest of your army can deal with that. Because all characters basically are designed for buffing, and that's what the Vindica is good at doing. But if there's no units left for them to buff, that character is left pointless.
True. What do you think of the Eversaw, Phil?
I think he's a bit of a beast. Like, the amount of, like, his damage potential is 8 attacks on the charge. And then potentially up to another 8 attacks just from killing Rampage. And then you can attack again and do that all over. Yeah, he's just really good. Like, he's the one that's had the most rules changes, and he's just so much better. He's also the best model out of the four in terms of my personal preference, but he's always the one I've liked the most. So I'm really glad that they've pimped him out a bit. I mean, this guy's going to be really good for just coming down. He's, you know, 3d6 charge. He's probably going to get into combat with whatever he wants to. He just, as long as he survives the Overwatch, but then you could potentially, you know, hide out a line of sight around a corner in a building or whatever. I think he's always going to do a decent job.
And you can quite comfortably, again, you're going to have to anyway if you have him arrive from reserves, but he can quite comfortably sit outside that 9-inch, you know, outside that 8-inch flamer range and still be pretty effective. I mean, I like him a lot. I think he probably is the one that you could argue maybe having two assassins for, but I think, or two of the same ones for, but I think, again, it's still, I suppose this is the thing, for 170 points you can get two assassins, or two Eversaur assassins, and hurl them at your opponent turn two. But then at the same time, it's whether or not you would keep him in your lines to use him. Because again, if you're up against Horde armies anyway, they're going to be quite aggressive towards you. I mean, against Orcs, this guy might die before he kills the optimum amount with the stratagem in effect.
Yeah.
But against anything else, like, again, against cultists, he's just going to murder everything. Against cultists, again, even 30 man blobs of cultists, because they're not necessarily going to drop him the same way orcs are. Against Termagaunts, again, should be fine as long as the Overwatch doesn't get ridiculously lucky. Against Hormagaunts, again, same sort of deal. I mean, they could do something back to him, but nothing hugely remarkable. Poxwalkers, again, he should be okay against, although Poxwalkers are frustratingly survivable. And then against things like Plague Bearers, which I suppose are the other more frequently used Nurgle kind of horde. I don't know. I don't know. He might bounce off of off of Plague Bearers. But at the end of the day, he'd give it a good go, though, right?
If he doesn't kill him, he's going to hold him up for a turn.
Well, we saw that when we ran two of them at that tournament that we did as doubles. They were our MVPs, right, in all our games. So, yeah, I think the Eversaws are cool. I think this has just made them cooler. It's a shame that they cost way more points than they used to, but they've definitely made up for it in their skill set. So, if I was to rank the assassins for myself, I'd say Eversaw is your number one. Vindicare is going to be number two, only because of his universal usefulness. He's always going to have a place. I just don't think you should ever take more than one of them. The Kaladas is coming in at number three for me. Again, she's got her place, but I think most of the time against a skilled opponent, she's not going to actually do what you want her to do. And the Kaladas Assassin, as I say, I would like to be proven wrong, but currently do not know what I'm supposed to think of that model. It just doesn't, or that rule set, it just isn't really doing anything for me yet. What would your rating be, Joe? Are you just going to mirror my own sentiment?
No, I'm gonna go Eversaw first.
Well, I said that as well, you see.
And then Kaladas second, Kaladas then Vindicare. I don't like Vindicus.
You've put the Kaluxus above the Kaladas.
Yeah, because
please explain.
because I think he's a good blocker unit, and in the current competitive, I'm gonna use competitive as an example. In the current competitive meta, with things like people running three hemlocks, stuff like that, who are going to be up in your grill, having him in a defensive role just to protect you from their smite attacks is super useful. And people using like Yvraine, stuff like that, being able to reduce her ability to soul burst like double move units around the table is super helpful.
I mean, don't get me wrong, mate. I think what you're saying is somewhat fundamentally sound, although you've used a terrible example in the Hemlock, because the Hemlock, I don't think the Hemlock's going to worry about this guy. And Hemlocks aren't actually very competitive meta. People take one now. No one's really taking loads.
Well, you take one now, but I think there are a lot of people still taking three.
I think the thing with Hemlocks, though, is their move is so high, they just plonk themselves right next to the thing they want to smite, unless you've screened really well. And the Kluxus doesn't need to be there to do that, because, like I said, his bubble isn't particularly a good defensive bubble, unless you've got to basically be next to the psychic inches.
So people use Hemlocks to go up and snipe out key characters if your opponent's stupid enough to leave, if you're stupid enough to leave a hole for him to sneak into. You want those Kluxes there defending them from those smites.
The smite isn't the thing getting it done, mate. It's the 2d3 strength 12 minus 4 2 damage flamers that gets it done.
Yeah.
I mean, admittedly, again, you only really ever do that. Again, we're going off on a whole tangent.
But also, I think he's a good distraction unit as well, and a survivable distraction unit. So if you put him up in your opponent's lines, like if you've got two of these things, your opponent has to deal with them.
I don't understand that argument either, because I just ignore him. What would he do?
Well, he's going to go around, kill characters and stuff.
Is he? How?
Yeah. With his close combat and his shooty gun.
His shooty gun's pretty good.
His shooty gun's okay. I'll give you that. Shooty gun's all right. But it's one damage minus 4, and you can still take invuns against it.
He's still going to be contesting objectives. I think he's more versatile.
He'll be contesting objectives now. I'm scraping the barrel. He'll be a presence.
I think he's better than a Vindicator. Once a Vindicator's killed, like, a character, if he can see it because your opponent's hidden them, he's useless. He sits in his one place at the back of the board shooting Forgo infantry.
Or doing mortal wounds to vehicles.
Yeah, maybe. I just don't think he's as good.
Very well. There we are. Phil?
Well, you know, thinking about the Kluxus, the one thing I think he's going to be really good at is actually being a really good deep strike screen. Basically, have him sort of 9 inches away from your important stuff that's probably going to get charged. And it means, like, okay, so some boys are going to do the jump, or some space marines are going to jump back down. They're going to basically have to go for the Kluxus first. And it's like, great, you're now charging one model and you've got to hit him on a 6. It's like your big guy, your smash captain or whoever, is wasting a turn trying to kill something they probably can't. I've come up against them and I had like a squad of 5 Rough Riders do absolutely nothing to them. And it's like, they were like my one good close combat unit. So I think actually a defensive sort of screen for your much more important stuff, just in terms of like combat and shooting, specifically combat, I guess, from Deep Strike, is sort of more powerful than its sort of psychic ability. Obviously, that's nice as well. If I was to rate the Assassins, I have to agree with Dan, I think. Eversaur would definitely be number one, because it's cool model, like really good rules. Probably I'll then go for a Vindicare, just because In terms of my army, because actually the assassins overall are really good for my army, because I've got, like, you know, I'm guard. I've got loads of CP, but I don't really have much to spend it on. I don't have any sort of decent anti-psycho. I don't have any sniping abilities to take out characters. And I don't have any really good close combat units. So the assassins sort of fill the smorgasbord of things I could want to do in my army. So I think the Vindicator will fill a nice role of killing out key characters that I need to get rid of. Yeah, then it would be the Calidus, I think, just because I think I almost think the ability to charge people extra CP for stratagems is more important than what the Calidus can do in terms of psychic ability. I sort of rate them, yeah, maybe the Cluxus at the bottom, but only just.
I mean, you raised a good point about his defensive potential. I think that's definitely something to be said for that. But I think you're paying a heavy premium for that.
Oh, I was going to say, what was interesting, looking back at the old points cost. So the Calidus used to cost 80 points.
Mm-hmm.
The Cluxus used to cost 85. The Eversor used to cost 70. So he's gone up 15 points. Mm. And the Vindicator used to cost 90. So he's gone down 5. So he's the only one that's gotten cheaper.
Yeah.
And was arguably a lot worse and is now way better.
Yeah. Yeah, they've made the Vindicator interesting for sure. And I think, you know, I think the Vindicare's got a place. I think the Eversaur is the one that is your universally useful one. I think the Vindicare is probably... I think genuinely speaking, if I was going to take a Vanguard detachment of these guys, I would go with probably one Vindicare, two Eversaurs. But realistically, I'm never going to do that. I'm going to just consistently use the stratagem to have them appear as I need them to. And I love that stratagem in the spirit of kind of tournament play, because now it gives Imperium generals a really interesting, nuanced addition to their army where they can do a little bit of sideboard list tailoring, which is definitely something that could potentially enhance the already very strong Castellan list, potentially. It just depends on what you're actually going to get rid of to put that 85-point assassin into the mix, I guess.
And I'm right in thinking you can basically super-soup your army now, because effectively you can take four detachments, because you get your three detachments of whatever you want. So guard, knights, and let's say some death watch. And then you spend your stratagems to gain yourself assassins on top of that. So it's odd. It's interesting how it sort of breaks the detachment format, but does it in a kind of very sort of narrative and interesting way in terms of how assassins probably should work.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm totally cool with that scenario, though. I think, again, it makes more sense within the way that assassins are. They are, you know, these commissioned killers for the Imperium. And if you're an Imperium general, there's no reason why your army couldn't benefit from an assassin. And, yeah, I like it, because it doesn't stop you from being Battleforged. It doesn't stop any of that nonsense. It's just have an Imperium assassin and go at it. And, yeah, no. Overall, super impressed with this. This is really, really good, you know, rules writing for the assassins. I'm interested to see if this resides within White Dwarf forever or whether we'll see a digital release or some kind of, like, this will be in some supplement at some point. With the way White Dwarf is at the moment, I'm guessing we'll probably get an end of year, like, the rules of White Dwarf 2019 or something. I don't know. It'd be interesting to see how that comes together.
Isn't that what Chapter Approved used to be?
Yes.
When they'd combine all the stuff together.
Yeah, well, it would make sense that Chapter Approved would just have this in them, just as a collected omnibus of rules.
Yeah.
Boom, boom. And with all that said, I feel like it's time to move on to the next segment. So with no further ado, let's go do that. Woo!
And now we're on to the bit that I'm super duper excited about. And that is the pain engine / rumor engine / demon something. GW have basically been previewing little snapshots of the upcoming new Chaos release, which I am super duper super duper excited about, and I cannot wait, because I'm all about that Chaos.
But Joe, the internet says that this is bad because you're teasing it for too long, by crikey. What do you say about that?
I said that these are big baby-faced men. They need to get over themselves. Anyway, as I was saying, so they've been releasing all these cool snapshots so people can build the excitement over the last 10 days before we eventually see Abaddon in all his glory.
But, Joe, I'm not excited. I'm angry that I've had to see the same image, or not the same images, but a series of images over the last 2 weeks. I would rather they did nothing than this abomination.
I don't know. I don't know why people would be angry. Right.
It does confuse me quite profoundly. Like, again, accepting the fact that, like, we're very spoiled today because, you know, I still very clearly remember the Games Workshop of 4 or 5 years ago where we were told nothing 100% of the time. And I do understand. I totally get it because I watched a few of the YouTube commenter people talking about how, it just seems like this is taking forever and that ultimately, you know, people want to see the models now. And I get that, that, you know, in the modern world, people want that instant gratification. But, you know, I'm kind of happy with the fact that we're even getting the opportunity to have them tease stuff to us. Because,
yeah, if you think about it in film terms, right?
Right.
For Infinity Avengers End War, whatever, Endgame, the new one coming out.
I appreciate your in-depth knowledge of Avengers film names right here.
Yeah, right then. Anyway, so they released literally like a 5-second trailer, and then they'll be like, here's a picture. Here's an obscure picture of someone's arm with a tiny gadget on it, and then they'll be like, here's a 10-second trailer. And like, no one's getting outraged about that, and they're spreading that out over months.
People are
lapping it up, kind of thing. But whereas this, they've gone, Abaddon's going to turn up in 80 days on the, what is it, next Tuesday. So if they 80 days ago, or 74 days, 76, God, maths. 76 days ago, they've gone, on the 4th of March, we will reveal everything. People would be like, crikey, that's a long time. Why are you even bothering to tell us now? But they've built up this hype all the way along. And they've backed it up with regimental standard and little teasers and stuff and little and like books and stuff for people to read. It's this gradual build up, but I think it's. I don't think it's. Like, I don't think it's the Chaos players that are complaining. It's the because they're the ones that are building that hype. They're the ones that are really excited. They go, we haven't had a new Abaddon model in 20 years.
Longer, I think.
Longer than that. We haven't had new Chaos Space Marine, actual Chaos Space Marine models in 15 years. Maybe even longer. Like, all this stuff is great. Nom, 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 nom. But it's those kind of keyboard warriors at home that just want to complain about pointless nothing. That they're just like, we want it now. Instant gratification. We're just going to troll you and throw memes at you until you give in and give us what we want. But we don't really care about it because we're not going to buy it when it comes out.
I mean, if I could play devil's advocate in this arrangement, I'd say that the people who are saying that they want that instant gratification or that they're saying they want to just see the models now are essentially just kind of stating that they're frustrated with the overabundance of focus on this Chaos release and that armies like the Orcs during October didn't get this same level of support and that ultimately they're just sort of wanting Warhammer community to go back to its consistent, you know, content updates like it usually does and not to focus so exclusively on this Chaos rumor engine, demon engine thing. So I can kind of understand why people can come at this and be frustrated by it, but I think the important thing here is to try and sort of stay positive about this and still obviously try and remember what this represents for the hobby as a whole and actually understand that this is an exciting new release for the game of 40K, seeing the return of Abaddon and new Chaos Space Marine models and a new range of Chaos Space Marine models is something significant. I think it deserves a bit of extra hype and enthusiasm from the community team. Is it frustrating as a fan who wants to see more and myself get that immediate kind of understanding of what I'm looking at? Of course. I mean, you know, I look at these Rumor Engine images and go, oh, I can't wait to actually see the thing when it's finally done. But at the same time, you know, it's cool they're doing this, and obviously now we're going to speculate on what this stuff is and what we might expect to see, I guess. So, sorry.
If I admit, like when people complain about October, and they get the same, they did. It's just that all the stuff from Speed Freaks got put out early by another company. So they had that kind of, oh, look what's coming, what exciting times, taken away from them by a spoiler. Because all the way through October, Games Workshop was still putting out how to paint tutorials, background stories, Vigilis information, kind of stuff like that. So they're still getting everything that Chaos got. But because someone had dropped that picture, the suspension got taken away from them. And the Orc release was huge as well. They've got 4 or 5 new buggies and characters, and a new codex and stuff. A lot of people are already going like, ah, why aren't Eldar getting new models? Kind of stuff like that. It's like, Jesus, let this release come out, and then I'm sure someone else will get their turn.
Well, exactly. And again, you know, I'm fine with this personally because, you know, it's just nice that we get consistent updates on anything these days. And, you know, again, as I say, I remember the olden days where we knew nothing about anything until it was a week away from release. And we were all trawling through horribly photographed images of the upcoming White Dwarf magazine on Bell of Lost Souls or wherever we found our various rumours back in the day. And I'd rather this and support this and continue to appreciate and actually support Games Workshop's desire to engage with us as a community and give us things like this than try and paint this as a negative.
And it shows that GW care as well. Because if you look at GW's release schedule last year, it was just, and the 6 months before that, it was just, here's a codex, bam, here's new models, bam, here's a new codex, bam. Like, every week was just a constant shoving of new stuff down people's throats, relentlessly. And now GW have gone, okay, that's all done, that's all the way. We can now sit back and release stuff at a calmer pace and keep the quality up. And people are turning around and like, hang on, you've completely done a U-turn on us. Mm. And that's not what we're used to anymore. And I think a lot of people are just it's going to go back to the Stone Age when we got new models released every 6 months and we only found out about it in White Dwarf 3 days before release.
I mean, if that is the case, that's the case, but I don't think that's what we're going to be looking at. GW has to continue to sustain and deliver growth year on year, and they support their growth as a business through a accelerated pace of product releases, and I think, you know, I don't think there's any risk that we're going to go back to those days. But I noticed that Phil has been awfully quiet during this last little moment. How do you reckon, or what do you feel about all this, Phil?
Well, I'm probably not the target audience for Demon Engine. So when I've sort of been keeping an eye on it, but not that, you know, closely. So, because it is like, it's a sort of unidentifiable bit of gribbly chaosness, okay. And then the next one is another unidentified bit of gribbly chaosness. So I could see why people are getting a bit frustrated, because if each one was clearly, this is like a new unit type that we've not seen, then that's something to get excited by, even if you can't see what it is. So, you know, if you look at the very last one, for example, which is clearly like some kind of leg of a big spidery chaos thing, but clearly not of the one that has been previewed already. So that one, I think, is really interesting. Some of them are like the first one, was the back of a jump pack or back of a power pack. You know, some of them are a bit bland, but I get it. It seems like it is actually going to be a really huge release, and they are supporting it with, you know, some stories and stuff as well. But, you know, potentially they could have just shown us one complete photo of a model. And even if every day they showed us 10 different Chaos generic Space Marines, like, that would still be cool, but it wouldn't be quite the same build-up that they're doing. And I can kind of see that the whole... It's tied in into the narrative of Chaos isn't on Vigilus yet, with the exception of some Vanguard Raptors that are basically harassing the spires of the Hives, if you read the sort of campaign book. Like, that's what's happening at the moment, and you've got Harkin, or whatever his name is. And then there's talk in the latest Regimental Standard about how there's a big warp surge coming, and how the Regimental Standard thinks it's Gilliman, but it's clearly going to be Abaddon and his army. Or Abaddon? Yes. So I can see why they're basically going to be like, you know, the day he's arriving, I assume it's just going to be a massive splurge of Chaos pictures, a bit like, probably even more so than what you got from the LVO preview. Because the LVO preview showed us some stuff, but I was actually expecting to see Abaddon there and more, and I think they've deliberately saved it for this to tie it all into the Vigilus 2 book.
I think the payoff of all of this is going to be remarkable. I think you're going to see an incredible range of models in addition to what they showed at the LVO, and I think you're going to be overwhelmed by the amount of stuff that they're actually going to be pouring into this release, which is incredible. I mean, we already know from the LVO that there's new Obliterators, and I made my opinions on those known in the last episode, which was to say I wasn't a fan of the new models, but it's cool that they exist. I mean, to be clear, even if I don't particularly like a model, I like the fact that they're supporting ranges and doing new things with old ideas, although I may not personally like how they've developed those ideas or how that model looks. I'm still grateful, or grateful is not the right word for it, but I'm still excited about the fact that new things are happening. And I think this, the great thing is we know new Chaos Space Marines are coming. We know that there's new Obliterators. We know there's new Demon Engines. We know there's new characters. We know there's a big War Master on the way, and this is super exciting. And those things in isolation would probably, you know, deliver a very consistent and exciting amount of new stuff for an army. But I think this Black Legion release will eclipse even those. And I think, again, for me, what this rumor engine thing has shown me is that they've got enough content that they can fill 3 weeks of hype or, you know, stuff, which is amazing. And yeah, sure, some of it may all be from the same kits, but I really wish they'd kind of steadfast on their, on continuing to drip feed out these images, because today, the 28th of February, they put out an image of a possessed Marine in its entirety, and I kind of feel like it's a shame, because it has robbed something from the approaching release, because now all of a sudden we're like, oh yeah, possessed Marines, more of him, okay, cool. Oh, that one's cooler, or that one's that, and this one's this. But we know, we now have seen a possessed Marine, so we know it's a thing. We kind of knew it was gonna be a thing, but now we definitely know it's a thing. So it's like, okay. And also, if I can say it as well, not to just focus on this, we've still got a bunch of new Primaris things that could also drop on that day as well. So it could be like ridiculous in terms of the amount of stuff we could be expecting to see.
When they announce Shadow Strike, whatever his name is.
Yep.
That is a, but they've said that is a box of two armies of entirely new models.
Mm.
but nothing in there is a reprint. And they've only shown off 4 models from that box set for the Primaris Marines.
Yeah. But I also think as well that I think it's quite clear that Black Legion are getting a separate release on top of that, which is the exciting stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean...
Well, do you think they're getting a brand new codex, or do you think it's just going to be like the Vigilus book? Because obviously Vigilus 2 book is coming. Do you think all the rules are just going to be in that, or if they're going to separate them out?
I imagine it'll be in the Vigilus book, much like they did for the War on Fenris, when Thousand Sons were released, and all their rules were just in that book. Because in the last Vigilus book, you had Kalgar, his Bicatrix Guard, and Harkon Worldclaimer, and they were happy to put the rules in there. So Obliterators will probably just get their old rules still. So I imagine Abaddon might get new rules, but I doubt it. So
yeah, he must get new rules.
No, mate. Abaddon 100% has new rules. There's no way he's staying the same.
I would have thought the majority of the Chaos will get tweaked rules.
I think we're looking at a Black Legion codex, mate. I can't see this not being an entirely new codex, because if you put this in the Vigilus book, it basically then just means the Vigilus book becomes Chaos Space Marines and these new Primaris Marine stuff, which is fine, but I think you're talking about so many new options here that I think it has to be its own codex. And I think the Vigilus book just gives you the Primaris Marine rules.
Yeah, I guess so, because the Shadow Strike book, or box set, isn't actually the Shadow Spear, but it's not set on Vigilus. It's on Nakamund Gauntlet. Or Nemendgast.
Yeah, so that's the gauntlet that Vigilus is the gateway of.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's within the Vigilus system.
A Nemendgast, where this is all based, is an industrial world within the Vigilus system.
Yeah.
So it's not on Vigilus Prime, where all the stuff's kicking off.
But it's still within, you know, spitting distance of all of that. I think the thing that's super interesting about all of this, I think, in terms of what this will end up being, is that if it is a new codex, I think it's going to be really interesting to see what impact that potentially has on the existing Chaos Space Marine book, whether or not it is itself an entirely new Chaos Space Marine book that can be taken as Black Legion or taken as other potential Legion variants. My suspicion is that it's going to become a definitive Black Legion book for just them, but then it becomes interesting, I guess, in terms of how that interacts with the existing Black Legion options that you get in regular Chaos Space Marines. Do they just put that stuff in? Will you still be able to take Rubik Marines or Plague Marines or Khorne Berserkers or Noise Marines? These are all really interesting things that I think definitely can be explored and show off some really great potential, I think.
I imagine you will be able to take Noise Marines, Plague Marines and Rubik Marines, just because as part of like the Black Legion lore, Abaddon's gone around and collected all of these different Space Marines from different traitor legions.
Mm.
And basically, they're throwing off the shame of their past and being reborn in black armor.
Mm.
So I imagine you'll still be able to run everything. So I always imagine it's just going to be Chaos Space Marine Codex 2.0.
It depends, doesn't it? Because it depends whether that is the case or whether they just go, no, it's just Black Legion. And I think that is the better way to play it, is to give Black Legion its own book would be, I think, more sensible. And then look at Chaos Space Marines down the road once you've made some wider decisions.
But then would it make... Because like, obviously they've announced today the new Possessed model isn't just a normal possessed. It's in the thing that was released today, they say that the new possessed aren't normal possessed. It says he will reward them with transformation into greater possessed. So this is like an entire new possessed unit. So scaled up to match things like aggressors, I think. Because that's not a 32 mil bases on, that's a 40 mil Terminator base that guy's running around on.
So the girl Vorback, or Verback, Vorback.
Vorback, yeah.
There you go.
So, yeah, I think, so it means, like, will people like Iron Warriors players, Night Lords players, be able to use these new possessed? Are they going to be able to use the new obliterators? Because if the obliterators are getting new rules, it'd be unfair for Iron Warriors players to have to use the old ones.
Mm.
So will they just do these new data sheets replace the Codex ones?
Potentially, yeah. But again, it depends on, again, how all those things kind of come together, I guess.
And then if they do that, they are forcing themselves into a position where half the data sheets in the Chaos Codex become redundant.
Yeah, potentially. But again, it depends, doesn't it, in terms of whether they're like, oh, this is a new Black Legion thing, and then the old stuff still applies. But, you know, yeah, they might just be different variants. So they might not be obliterators in the traditional sense. They might be super-duper obliterators or whatever they get called. I mean, looking through the rumor images, rather than get into the particular details, I guess, do we want to just maybe pick an image each and just kind of talk about it, or try maybe a series of images that clearly relate to one thing?
Well, I'm happy to select like an image or two and then just talk about it.
Go on then, Joe, you kick us off, mate. Which day are you going to pick?
Oh god, this is the difficult bit, you see, because Games Workshop is updated their silly website, and now I can't find it. I think it might have been yesterday's, actually.
Very well, very well. Maybe while you're working that out, I could kick off with mine, or would you prefer to go first?
There's one from yesterday, so the 27th, which was the front end of a Chaos autocannon.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm hoping it means a new Havoc squad. Because they've shown a picture of the other picture coincides with this, which is blatantly a man-portable heavy bolter.
Yeah, so, which so, Chaos Space Marines have always had, or not always.
They've always had a heavy bolter in their squad. Mm. So when that heavy bolter was released, people were like, oh my god, like new Havocs. And they said, well, actually, no, because the standard squads always had a heavy bolter in it. Mm. But now with this auto cannon, which is it's look like for like exactly the same as the metal kit.
Mm.
So that's what I'm hoping it is, because it's definitely not the Terminator one, because the Terminator one's got two big barrels.
Well, because this is the thing, isn't it? Because it's quite clear with the heavy bolter that it's being held by a powered armored marine, because you've got the underslung heavy bolter design with the guy holding the kind of grip for it. So that's quite obvious. In the case of this autocannon, or this Reaper autocannon, although I think that's the Terminator variant, it's quite likely that this probably is a weapon upgrade for the Space Marine squad. It also depends on what kind of upgrades they're actually offering in the box, right? Is it going to be that this Space Marine box now can be assembled to offer you humongous levels of variety? Will it have four different variants of heavy weapon in there, the ability to arm them all with melee weapons, the ability to arm them all with bolters? I mean, it could be really exciting to see what kind of capabilities that could offer.
Because potentially, because the current Space Marine one allows you to take a missile launcher, a heavy bolter, and then a bunch of guys with bolt guns, but in there there's the options to have multiple people with close combat weapons and multiple people with bolt pistols. So
that's not been the... Well, that's what they've got for the old tactical Marines. Like, the current range of models tends to be very sort of... not necessarily mono pose, but very mono build. So you only build things in a certain way.
Yeah.
Like, it's highly stylized. You think about all the Death Guard stuff, there's almost zero customization in terms of weapon loadouts. Like, maybe arms at a push, but pretty much every unit has a specific loadout, and that's almost how you take them. Now, if you think of the Primaris, so I wouldn't be too surprised if they suddenly go, well, we're harking back to the Horus Heresy, and here's a squad of, like, not quite Devastators, but the old Horus Heresy equivalent, where it's all heavy bolters or all heavy weapons in one squad, and then you've got your Marines, your Chaos Marines with your bolters. That's another squad, and they're two separate kits, as opposed to one kit that does everything.
I mean, if I can interrupt on the topic of, say, like the Death Guard or the Plague Marines that you made, the actual Plague Marine kit is quite a bit customizable, quite a bit more customizable than you're kind of alluding to, because you've got an absolute ton of different weapon options in it. So you've got like the mace and sword combo that you can do, or mace and axe, sorry, combo you can do. You've got what is the equivalent of their heavy bolters, which are essentially like plague burst cannons or something of that nature. I can't remember what they're called. You got the icon bearer. You got the guy with like the melee weapon that's like a flail of maces. You got like the flamery guys. I mean, interestingly, the most inconsistent thing within the kit in terms of build seems to be the bolter variant. But again, when you look at people who put this kit together and you look at the sprues, there's lots and lots of options within it. So yeah, although your suggestion that the new 40K in the case of Primaris Marines offers only very limited builds, in the case of the Chaos stuff, as with the Death Guard, that's not actually accurate.
No, fair enough. I'm probably thinking more of the easy build.
Oh yes, of course, those ones. Those ones, you have one option, but yeah, for the multi-part plastic kit, the seven-man unit, you have a lot of flexibility within that, I believe.
Yeah, you do. And like the Thousand Suns box set gives you the bolter variant that allows you to have a sorcerer, but there's enough bits in there to make two sorcerers. And then enough guns so you can have 10 guys with bolters, and enough flamers so you can have 10 guys with flamers, and you've got the rotor cannon in there as well.
Mm.
So it's quite a versatile kit in what it gives you. So I wouldn't be surprised if the new squad, the new Chaos Marine squad, is identical to the old one in terms of you have enough stuff to make 10 bodies, 10 guys, and you have an option to give them all chainsaw bolt pistol or all bolters and a heavy bolter. And then you're going to have power sword, power fist, chain axe for the sergeant. And then we'll get a Havoc squad, which will have two heavy bolters, two auto cannons, two missile launchers, two las cannons, just like the current Devi squad box set does.
Mm. Potentially, anyway. Either that, or they'll sell it as like an upgrade box, like they've done with some of the shoulder pads or whatever. But yeah, so those are the two you want to talk about: the heavy bolter and the auto cannon. Yeah,
yeah, I'm good with those.
Very well. So I suppose for my two selections, or one selection, I want to talk about the one released on the 20th of February, the Power Fist, and speculate obviously what that potentially represents. Obviously, I'm super hopeful that it means that we're going to see some new type of Chaos Space Marine Terminator. Everything about this image kind of gives the impression of being a Terminator Power Fist, because of the you know, the kind of tube that runs up for the power pack, and the bolt in the arm that, again, is very synonymous with the Terminators. The chainmail effect that sort of sits over the top of the arm, again, kind of makes me hopeful that maybe it's some variant of Cataphracty Terminator, or maybe one of the Heresy versions of Terminator plate. And yeah, I just sort of feel like this could be super cool to see an updated Chaos Space Marine Terminator kit, even if it's just another Chaos Space Marine champion, potentially, as opposed to a full squad of Terminators. All of that would be super cool. And again, it sort of coincides with the image they put out on the 19th, which again looks like a trophy rack, which was, again, somewhat synonymous with the Terminator kit. So they always had their trophy racks and obviously power fists. So if this potentially is a new Terminator captain or Terminator Lord or an actual whole squad of Terminators, I'll be very, very happy with that. But it remains to be seen, I suppose. A unit of... Because what was the name of Abaddon's Terminator squad that was his in the first Legion? Does anyone remember?
The Justeran.
Yeah, so if this is the Justeran...
In the books, they're always described as having Cataphracty Terminator armor.
Mm.
The Forge-Rod ones look ever so slightly different and like a weird amalgamation of the two.
Mm.
But just as a way of like, I think you're right about it being Cataphracty, because that Power Fist is almost identical to the one on the Plague Marine Champion that Games Workshop sell, the one with Sassy Nurgling.
Mm.
Like, it's just... The arm, instead of being on the right side, is clearly on the left side.
Mm.
But it's almost identical in every way, and that's for Mark III.
Mm.
I imagine they keep that old look and give them the Cataphracty.
Which I would, really, really appreciate. Yeah. And again, if you look at the even like the old Cataphracty models or the Plague Marine Death Guard Cataphracty models, admittedly, if you look at those, actually, now that I think about it, they don't have the Power Fist as an option, do they? They just have a combination of axes and swords. But regardless of all that stuff, I think, again,
but the Cataphracty,
well, the Blight Lord Terminators,
then the Heresy plastics for them have all got spiky hand power fists.
Yeah, which is what you're seeing here, right? So again, I think if Abaddon is accompanied by a unit of super badass Jakaran?
Cataphracty?
No, the unit.
Oh, Justeran.
Justeran. A unit of Justeran Terminators that have amazing stats.
Yeah.
That'll be a thumbs up for me.
And I really hope they keep the Tusky helmets as well from the old ones.
Mm.
I quite like the idea of them keeping that aesthetic, because that gives them that cool standout look to the normal Imperial ones.
Mm.
So, yeah.
And what do you reckon, Phil? Any of this you want to talk about?
Yeah, so there's two. So there's one on the 23rd, which is like some kind of Bunsen burner, some kind of torch with a load of candles on.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the one on the 24th, where there's a load of chains hanging down with skulls on. So I'm guessing this is going to be their scenery kits.
Mm.
And I'm assuming it's some kind of giant... if it's not a temple or offering, it's probably some kind of symbol. Yeah, I mean, it could be like a giant Eye of Horus, for all we know, or some kind of warp gates, who knows, some kind of demonic icon that's going to be a massive scenery piece by the looks of it, judging by the scale of the one on the 24th, looks really big. So that'd be quite interesting to see what it is and what it does. Yeah,
I quite like the look of those ones, or the idea of that being some kind of scenery piece. Definitely seems cool. It'd be good, again, to have some kind of chaotic altar that, again, kind of amplifies the demonic rituals that Tim and the new sorcerer stuff's going to be able to do. So, yeah.
Well, that's what all the scenery pieces have done so far. It's amplified unit capabilities. And the knight one, especially, and the orc mech shop have annoyingly have both required the unit to be within it or next to it. I'm kind of hoping this one has more of a bubble effect, so you can kind of charge up a bunch of demon engines and then spring them forwards onto your opponent.
What, you want to see the Nurgle trees strike again, do you?
Yes and no. I don't think it should be as widespread. Because those Nurgle trees can power up 90 plague bearers all stringing into it in horrible little lines. And then all the characters and every other Nurgle unit stood by it. I'd quite like it just to be like demon engine keyword or possessed keyword, because then they can give the possessed keyword to the vehicles, the possessed unit, and obliterators. But it won't be as powerful as the tree, because these aren't massive squads that basically fill the board. They're just individual units or a maximum of five kind of thing.
No, it makes sense.
Yeah.
Well, with that all said, I feel like we've probably... Unless, Phil, do you have anything extra to add on these two things you've chosen?
No, not at all.
Lovely. Well, there we go. I would say that pretty much rounds out that bit. As I said from the outset, really happy that we've had such a consistent release of content, as always. Really excited for this release, even though I probably won't be buying any of it. But you never know. It's cool that Joe's gotten super into it already, so look forward to seeing what you do with it when it comes out, Joe.
Yeah, that's definitely gonna happen, because I've had many Chaos Armies in my life, and you even own two of them.
The demons
and the Iron Warriors, or were they just together? I can't remember.
No, I bought the Iron Warriors off you, then bought a demon army, and then got you to paint it.
Yeah, so I think this one's going to be like my Death Watch now, like my trying to be tournament army and failing because I used to bend to soup. But the Chaos are kind of going to be my fun army. I'm just going to get the units that I like and I think are cool and just paint them up as best I can. So these are going to be like my passion project, as it were.
Wicked. All right, well. With that said, let's move on. Transitional noise.
Woo! So, guys, we're now on the last segment of the day, which is a sort of a look back at an old codex, which is Codex Demon Hunters. And as I said earlier in the intro, Dan gave me this copy, and I've thoroughly enjoyed reading through it because I'm starting to collect an Inquisitional force, and I just thought it'd be a good sort of amount of lore and inspiration, and I sort of wanted to share my findings with you in terms of just generally what the codexes were like back then, but also some interesting rules and some other bits that I've found. So Codex Demon Hunters has a glorious cover on the front, all in colour, with a splendid golden Inquisitor about to smash someone's head in with a big hammer. And then it was...
Inquisitor Cotiers, right?
Well, I would assume so, actually, but he's missing his little cyber eagle.
Ah, yeah, that'll be flying around somewhere, pecking someone's eyes out.
I'm pretty sure it is him. Although he looks then slightly different in the black and white artwork that appears later in the book, but they are both balding, so maybe it is him, but with different sort of armour.
So I'm sure there could be other Inquisitors clad in gold armour, wanging around with a massive hammer.
Yeah, so this came out in 2002, which is 1 year after the Inquisitor book. Now, obviously, I think this was very much inspired by a lot of the things that happened in the Inquisitor game, because that's where they properly fleshed out Inquisitors as a concept. And then another book comes out later, sort of in this series, which is Witch Hunters, which is Inquisition with Sisters of Battle. I'm not actually sure which one comes first. I assume maybe this one, and then Witch Hunters come second. Dan, could you hazard a guess?
I think, if I remember correctly, the Witch Hunters followed the Demon Hunters. So the Demon Hunters,
Actually, it is this one, because if I open it up to the very first page, it says the first book of the Inquisition, Malleus. So obviously it also ties in with how they structured the Eisenhorn trilogy as well.
Mm.
Because his first one was Malleus, I'm sure.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah, he even gets credit.
Yeah, because he's off in Cherubael, isn't he, in the first one?
Yes, and he even gets mentioned in this book as well. The Inquisition game has a lot to answer for, basically. And then, unfortunately, they never did a Xenos one, because obviously Deathwatch, was around, but never in miniature form in this edition and for many editions to come. So they only ever did two of the three. And then hopefully maybe one day we'll get these revised, bring them back up to 8th edition. So there's some nice things in here. So firstly, in these books, you get credits. Now, it sounds a bit of a stupid thing to say, but you don't get them anymore. And I think the reason why is probably down to Matt Ward, because he ruined so many codexes for people and probably got so much abuse, from what I remember. I think that's why they stopped putting credits on codexes, which is interesting as well, diverting off for a second, that when I got into the game, people always complained any bad rule was a Matt Ward rule. And this was 6th and 7th edition. And I don't think he was even working for them then. But then since 8th edition has been around, I've never once seen anyone do a Matt Ward reference. Well, it doesn't seem to be a thing anymore.
It's more of like a committee of people that make code. There is like an overarching writer. But obviously the rules now for 8th edition are all put out to playtesters and stuff.
Yes, yeah, because what happens in this book, they've got a little special thanks section, and at the very bottom it says the Ancient and Honourable Order of Tech Priests.
Mm.
And I thought that was a bit of an in-joke, but in the latest Age of Sigma podcast, the Stormcast one with Pete Foley, he mentions the Ancient Order of Tech Priests, and it was their original sort of testing group that they had, that were people outside of the rules writing team. So it's interesting that's where that name check comes from.
I think it's cool that they used to do credits. I don't understand why they stopped. Fair enough to Joe's point. A lot of Matt Ward's rules back in the day were a bit mad. But you know what? He also created some really, really interesting mechanics. Now, you know, for every Def Company Dreadnought Blood Talons, there were, a number of other interesting options. I think Phil Kelly's Space Wolf Codex was probably a much bigger offender than Matt Ward's Blood Angel Codex, although I did enjoy back then where Matt Ward had seemingly written the background and just had to get the words Storm Raven in as many places as possible. The Blood Angels got into their Storm Ravens. That's right, the new fantastic vehicle that you can buy exclusively via Blood Angels until they later come out in Grey Knights, but for now, Storm Ravens. Everything is Storm Ravens. Matt Ward also did the rule, didn't he, for Blood Angels, where you could deep strike a Land Raider, because he basically wrote, Blood Angels have loads of them, so they've basically forgotten the value of them, and are just hurling them out of planes now. It's like, I'm not so sure, but
that sounds pretty crazy. But I can imagine they yeah, but because people were probably getting abused online, no matter what part of the credits they were maybe doing, people were just unhappy with them, that they just said, we'll just stop doing it. But you're right, it is a shame that they're not doing it anymore.
I'd hate to think that someone who's, the Matt Ward thing, I never felt like people were harassing him. It was always just a little bit of, banter, I always felt. Matt was responsible for some mad rules, but I always sort of felt that, you know, in the grand scheme of things, within sort of that period of time, I don't think Matt's armies were always the most ridiculous. He just had a few interesting, funny little rules that he threw in. But it's interesting, isn't it, that they don't do it anymore. And I think it's a shame. I would be disappointed if I worked for months on a rule set and on a background and on a story, and I wasn't credited as being that creator. That would upset me.
Well, they do have like their podcast now. They've got the Age of Sigmar one, which is called Stormcast, and I can't. And then they've got Voxcast, and they're getting all the different designers and codex people on there. So I think they're actually, so instead of giving them a shout out in the books, they're actually giving them a good hour of airtime, really introducing these people. So when the Gloomspike Gits came out, they did a podcast all on the guy who wrote that codex, basically.
Which is totally fair enough. I just, as I say, it's one of those things where you just sort of think, well, fair enough. Just be nice just to put their names in the book, though, isn't it? It's like, if you're going to put them on, you know, your podcast talking about the projects, what's it harm you to just put their names in there as well?
True. I wouldn't be surprised if it's something they do change their minds on and add them back in the future.
No, I'd like to see them do that, but there you go.
Anyway, I'll carry on. To give you a bit of context, the book is 64 pages long, and the majority of it is black and white. And in terms of the modern-day codexes, most codexes now are over 100 pages, so almost double in size, but also double in price, I guess, because I think these were around 15 quid at a time, and now they're 30-odd, aren't they? 25.
25, 30. Actually, yeah. I imagine with inflation, it was probably more expensive to buy a codex back then than it is to buy one now. But
true.
Regardless, it's
true.
You know.
So the first few pages are, because one thing I've noticed is it's very light on narrative. I mean, it is there, but it's not in the same way that it is in the current books, where literally the first 70% is all story driven, setting the scene, and then you've got the rules. This is like you've got a bit of intro, a bit narrative. Then it pretty much dives into the rules straight away, and then all the background for the units, for example, is just with the units in particular. And there's and it's all sort of scattered around. It's not sort of as structured as well as the newer books. So it talks about like why you would want to collect demon hunters, and it introduces you to the idea with some narrative stories about the Inquisition. And then it talks about the Grey Knights and their military organization and the structure of them. And then it goes straight into the Grey Knights' special rules, talking about how they're fearless and can deep strike, and they've got their Aegis as well. And then there's quite a cool rule to do with the demonic infestation. So it basically means if you have a demon army, once you've killed the demons, they can come back on via a board edge using the sustained attack special rule, which I'm pretty sure meant they came in from a board edge rather than just deep striking down. And there's like a nice little designer's note with this. It says the demonic infestation rule is designed to intend to offset some of the Grey Knight's considerable advantages when fighting demons. This is done rather than simply making them cost more points, so they're not penalized unfairly when fighting non-demonic opposition, which seems to make sense. And I'm not entirely sure how they go about it in the current Grey Knight codex in terms of getting that balance right, because I think statistically, based on the LVO, the Grey Knights are like the worst performing faction out there at the moment.
The way they made Grey Knights not balanced against or not too powerful against demons is, well, bizarrely, they've made them, I think, demons because of that weird they can come back after they've been killed by Grey Knights thing, which I suppose is a reference to this old school rule. But it's quite mad because actually the demons aren't hugely penalized against Grey Knights in the way that you think they would be, so.
Well, because in this edition, I guess, I don't know if the instant death rule was still a thing, but the force weapons used to be really devastating against them, and I guess maybe that's just been toned down now.
In third edition, which was when that book came out, demons at that time were not actually their own codex yet. So Chaos Space Marines had a section for demons,
it was like lesser demons, greater demons. So they all had like a shared stat profile.
Yes.
All the different.
Yeah, and then later on, with the revisions, I think there was a revision to the Chaos Space Marine Codex later on. Again, I can't remember the particulars of it, but I think there was a revised Chaos Space Marine Codex, which then introduced like god variants to the demons. Because I think
it was a Black Crusade book.
Was that what it was? Because there was one thing, wasn't there, where all of a sudden you could start doing those ridiculous armies where you take a Slaanesh sorcerer and then you give it the lash of submission, and then it would draw in. It would basically make your opponent deep strike a unit towards you, and then you'd use obliterators with plasma cannons and just go, have all of these, because it was ridiculous, because the old deep strike rule was that you had to be within base-to-base contact with everything. You couldn't just fan out and not be within 9. You had to do those little circles, didn't you, around the first guy. So it used
well,
to be
wasn't the... that... It had something to do with a large ordnance template, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, because what you did, you'd place them, and then you'd use the lash of submission to bring them towards you, and then you just use plasma cannons, which had the small blast template, just to basically hit and hit and hit and hit, and it was crazy because you'd literally just be like wiping out units because you just bundle them up and murder them, which was hilarious fun.
Awesome. Well, let's carry on. So the demonic infestation rule only really applies in this edition to the demonic pack Nurglings and demonic beasts. So it excludes things like greater demons and other types of demons and demon princes and stuff. So I think that probably is how they balanced it out in this edition. And then if I turn over the page, we then go into the Inquisition, talking about the Ordo Malleus, giving you the background on it. Talking about the Puritan Inquisitions to start off with, which are the holier-than-thou, goody-two-shoe ones. But they're very pious. And then the instantly more interesting ones, which are the radical Inquisitions, Inquisitors, which are the ones that use chaos to an extent against chaos, so things like demon hosts. So you basically have Eisenhorn starting off his career as very much a Puritan Inquisitor. And then by the last book, no spoilers, he becomes a bit more of a radical Inquisitor. So that's all kind of really interesting stuff, and it then covers all the psychic powers that they get access to, some of which are pretty interesting. One of them is called Holocaust, which I don't think you'd probably get them calling a rule nowadays.
That's
maybe
amazing.
That'd be seen as a bit too taboo.
Yeah, no, I can't imagine they'd ever use that word ever again in their game, but yeah, well, fair enough.
Yeah, and then it gets to the, it's talking about the individual units for the henchmen, which is probably my favourite part of the book, because there's a double page spread with some John Blanche illustrations representing each one. So you've got 6 different types of henchmen that you can take. You've got a familiar, hierophant, acolyte, warrior, sage, and mystic. And then underneath each one, they break down into what they could be. So, for example, the sage could be an auto savant, a lex mechanic, or a calculus logi. And for example, the mystic is an astropath, a warp seer, or a sanctioned psyker. And things like the warrior represents an Imperial Guard veteran, a combat servitor, or a gun servitor. So within each bracket, you have a range of different models that could be used in different narrative ways to represent them. Mm. And each henchman gives effectively a buff either to the unit or to the Inquisitor. So, for example, the Sage, having one of them gives the Inquisitor +1 to his ballistic skill. And then if you've got 2 of them, then the Inquisitor or a member of his retinue and reroll failed hit rolls. And then each one gives them a different buff. So a familiar gives you +1 initiative and allows you to take extra psychic powers. The warrior gives you +1 to your weapon skill. So you can build up a warband, a retinue, to be more correct, of different guys. And effectively, you're almost encouraged to have, rather than min-maxing, like, you know, 5 of the same. Because actually, I don't think you can really even do that. You're encouraged to almost take 1 of each because that benefits you the most.
Yeah, it's interesting mechanically because Do those models actually yield any... are they themselves a unit that can be used in the game, or are they purely there to buff the Inquisitor?
Oh, no, they are actual models. So they've got a base stat line, which is like an equivalent guardsman. So it's, you know, weapon skill, ballistic skill, toughness, strength, all threes. Yeah, one wound, a 6+ save. So they're very much like bog standard, and they're armed with, by default, a digital weapon. Oh, it actually doesn't say. It says from digital weapons to industrial chainsaws. And then depending on which one you pick, I believe you then get armed with different weapons.
I always remember just people running around with the guardsman option plasma guns. That was like the default one I always saw people running.
Yeah, because it says if you take the warrior henchman, the henchman becomes ballistic skill 4, gets a 4+ armor save, a hell gun, a targeter, and comes with frag and crack grenades. And for some extra points, you can take a flamer, plasma gun, melter gun, grenade launcher.
Yeah.
And then you can also have a combat servitor or gun servitor, which gives you access to different guns instead.
That's cool.
Yeah.
And then they've got your sort of the Demon Hunter's armory. And I'll pick out just two things that I really liked in here, which are sort of more narrative hooks, but have actual interesting game mechanics. So one of them is the Emperor's Tarot, which is known as almost being their equivalent of, you know, the normal human tarot deck, but is obviously divined by the Emperor. So this rule says the Inquisitor is adept at consulting the Emperor's Tarot to reveal the course of the future and can gain valuable insight into the outcome of the coming battle. Both players roll a dice before deployment. If the dice rolls are different, the Demon Hunter player gets +1 on the dice roll to ascertain who goes first. If the dice rolls are the same, he suffers -1 to the roll, and you can have one per army. So it's a really nice mechanic.
Hmm.
It's something that you don't see in this edition. I mean, because it was either at the very beginning, everyone went first if you finished deploying first. I guess now you roll off. So now equipment like this would be a bit more interesting to see in the game. Mm. Maybe it'd be seen as too powerful, though, in terms of like trying to balance it. I don't know.
I think it's interesting, though, isn't it? Because back in 3rd edition, there was a very different ethos when it came to erratas and FAQs, and they kind of were stuck with the rules. But I think what was super interesting about that, it was the fact that, yeah, they were more confident creating rules that weren't then going to, you know, need to change for any significant period of time, because I think like now with all the erratas and the changes frequently happening, they try and leave things like that alone because something may drastically change, which is a wise move on their part. But again, it's just good to see it. I think again, a mechanic like that would be super useful in 8th edition as it is today, in a match play setting, for sure.
And for 15 points, would you always take it?
What, the ability to add +1 to my roll?
Yeah.
Yeah, I probably would.
Yeah, I'd have thought so too.
Yeah.
You're gone.
No, I'll pay a CP for it, or whatever it happens to be. Yeah, I would gladly pay a 15-point tax, or pay a CP, or pay 2 CPs to get the +1. But then it depends how it works, doesn't it? Because then I guess it becomes a thing that both of us could have, and then it cancels itself out, but whatever. I do always say, and again, this is going off on a massive tangent, so I won't dwell it along, but I think CPs could be an interesting mechanic that could be used more efficiently within that roll-off exchange, whether you could gamble CPs or stake CPs or something like that. You know, it's an in-game resource that you could potentially leverage against an outcome that you want, which is going first or whatever it might be. But anyway, we're digressing massively. Carry on, Phil.
Okay. The next one is the Grimoire of True Names. It says, in rare cases, Demon Hunter will bring an ancient and hallowed grimoire to the battle, inscribed with the true names of all the demons encountered by his order. Because knowledge of the demon's name gives power over that entity, demons in base contact with the character equipped with this item halve their weapon skill, rounding down once per army. So I just really like it from a narrative point of view. It's like a cool conversion point of view, and it's got a cool game mechanic as well.
Yeah, that used to stuff a lot of, like, blood letters, or not blood letters, but bloodthirsters and things like that, having someone step up in front of you and go, I know your name, now your weapon skill 4 or 3 or whatever it happened to be, depending on what demon it was. It was a big deal.
Yeah,
it'd be super useful now.
Yeah, how would you do it though? So say if someone's got weapon skill of 3 up, how do you halve that or double it? Like, would you just use 2?
Well, most of the demons are hitting on 3s, aren't they? 3s and 4s. So it'd just be like a -1, maybe.
Yeah, they'd probably just do -1 to hit, or -2.
So all demons within an inch, or within 3 inches of them.
Yeah, I think that something like that would be pretty cool. Because obviously at the moment, in the current rules for Inquisition, it's like they don't really get anything. They get equipment and war gear, but no... Well, they get weapons and very little in the way of like war gear and equipment that they can take. And obviously no stratagems either.
It does feel like in the current edition, and again, respecting the relatively limited resources they had back in 2002 when they put this rule set out, the Inquisition does feel like something that is growing in scope now as a rule set, but they seem to explore it mostly through Space Marines. So it's Death Watch and it's Grey Knights. But the actual Inquisition hasn't really seen a good solid release, and I think that would be amazing if we actually saw a Scutari Adeptus Mechanicus style release for the Inquisition where we actually fleshed out all this stuff, because at the moment with Inquisitors there's Greyfax, Cotiers, Eisenhorn, and then a number of really tired old generic models that don't really do very much to be very dynamic. And then obviously the stuff that, like, what you're quite invested in at the moment, Phil, what's the group that
The Inc. 28.
Yeah, so the stuff those guys are doing is super inspiring in the way that they're taking kits and converting up inquisitorial warbands and so on, which is amazing to see. But it'd be great if Games Workshop actually did do more with this very, very rich piece of lore.
Well, it feels like they're slowly getting there, because if you look at the new releases and the new arena game that they've announced, so that has Crusader model in it and another Rogue Trader model. So it seems like they're focusing quite heavy on Rogue Traders at the moment. Mm. But within the original Rogue Trader boxed game for Kill Team, that had a Death Cult Assassin in, which again is in here as an inquisitorial element. Mm. And there's a lot of crossover between the Inquisitors and Sisters of Battle. So, for example, again, they have Crusaders and Death Cult Assassins and Flagellants, which are all models that Inquisitors sort of traditionally have. So it'd be interesting to see if they tie in Inquisitors with that, if there'd be just a brand new release and it'll be like a mini dex, or if it will just be like the Assassins that we talked about, where they just get updated rules in White Dwarf because they know they're not going to be doing anything with them for any long period of time. It feels like they're slowly drip feeding in new models.
So, yeah, no, very absolutely slow. Agreed. I mean, and having been on this trip down memory lane with the old books, Phil, I mean, what was your key takeaways from the whole thing? Was there any specific pieces of lore, or any specific things about going back through some of this old literature for 40K that was particularly thought-provoking?
There's some interesting bits. I mean, obviously they talk about let me dig out his name. It is there's some narrative elements that I want to talk about, which is sort of hooks for playing the army with any other type of army, to sort of explain why Demon Hunters would be fighting against Imperial Guard, or why Demon Hunters would be fighting against Elder. So obviously there's the most obvious things, which is that, oh, they're possessed, or they're under the influence of demonic forces. But I found 3 that I really liked, that I thought were a bit more interesting. So why would Demon Hunters be fighting orcs? This one is, the orcs have constructed a gargant with parts salvaged from a wrecked Banelord Chaos Titan, and the essence of the Chaos Titan has taken over the massive war machine. The demon hunters must get in and plant charges to destroy the Gargant before its psychic resonance acts as a beacon for Chaos Fleets and Renegades. Then there's another one, which is, why would demon hunters be fighting Tyranids? The demon hunters know of a powerful buried Chaos icon on a populated planet that the Tyranids have invaded. The scale of death will awaken a demon chained within the icon, and the demon hunters must halt the Tyranids before they reach it. And then lastly, why would they be fighting Elder? And it says the Avatar is pretty much a demon when you think about it.
It's even got the demon keyword in today's world, but yeah.
Well, there you go. And there's even, and they even give you within this two narrative missions as well, or just missions, I guess, in those days, which are very themed around, you know, one of them is you create circles with your Chaos Cultists because you want to try and form a ritual to summon someone. And then in the other mission, you've got a demon vessel, so you sort of secretly select, or maybe not so secretly select, one model that's going to represent your demon host, so to speak. Mm. And then depending on if that person gets damaged, you roll off every turn to see if the person's going to basically elevate into a demon prince and suddenly appear on the table. So there's some really cool like narrative sort of stories and hooks about how demons in Grey Knights and Inquisition work together. There's a little bit which I think is probably lifted from Malleus, because it talks about Inquisitor Quixos, who was the guy that basically created Cherubiel as one of the two demon hosts that he created. And it was talking about how he originally kind of fell down the path of Chaos from his puritanical inquisitorial nature. And basically, I think he was fighting someone and then basically got an evil demon claw stuck in his chest, and he couldn't actually ever remove it because if he did, he'd die, a bit like Tony Stark, I guess. But then that gave him power and knowledge, and he sort of went out and sort of he went out to sort of seek how to control it. And then they sort of heavily imply that even though he was slowly being corrupted by Chaos, he was always doing good, and that he was always using Chaos to fight Chaos. So when Eisenhorn does finally kill him, a lot of people are like, well, it's a bit of a shame because he was doing a good job. Yeah, he was a heretic, but he was like a heretic doing a good thing. So it's a bit, depending on your point of view, of course, I guess.
Absolutely. All heretics are evil. Death to the heretics.
Yeah, and there was one last cool rule, which is for the Grey Knights, for Brother Captain Stern. And then I had to go and check in the new codex to see if the rule still exists, and it does to an extent. So he's got two rules. One of them is the Strands of Fate. So he's got an ability that allows him to achieve feats of true heroism, and his nemesis, Makachen, does everything in his power to bring about his downfall, and to ruin of Stern's allies. So Brother Captain Stern may reroll one dice per phase, although he must accept the result of the second dice. Keep track of the number of times Stern uses this ability in any given turn, so he can do it as many as he wants, basically, but once per phase. His opponent may subsequently reroll one of his own unit dices per use of that ability. So you can reroll, I guess, once per phase, so potentially like five dice a turn, and then the more you do that, the more rerolls your opponent gets as well, which I quite like the concept of. And I checked it in the new rules, and it's a similar thing, but it's only once per turn, and it's only for a handful of certain rolls, like saves and wounds and hits, I think. And then your opponent gets one roll for that as well. So it's a slightly toned-down version.
Well, I think there were only three phases back then as well. Well, maybe four. I think it went morale, movement, shooting, combat.
Okay. Yeah, that would make sense.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that's how it all came together. Because you had to roll for leadership at the end of every phase, depending on casualties. So obviously you didn't do it at the end of the movement phase unless someone had done something quite tremendous.
Yeah.
Or was it? Oh, actually, no. Maybe you rolled for morale at the end of the movement phase. So you actually did the run And then you roll to see if they rallied, and then it'd be the shooting for, yeah.
Well, I thought it was when, like, whenever you took, like, 25% casualties or you lost in combat.
Yes, yeah. And that would make you run away. What I'm saying is that I don't know if there was, like, an upkeep morale phase before a movement phase back then, or whether they actually rolled for morale after they'd moved. So if they were running, you'd run your 2d6 towards the nearest board edge. And then if you didn't run off the board, you rolled a morale test to see if you stuck around.
Well, I thought you rolled before you moved. If you failed, you carried on running.
Well, yeah, well, that was, so that was the 7th, 6th edition variant of it. I don't think that was the case in 3rd, but I can't remember.
Because it was like, if there's an enemy unit still within 6 inches of you, you carried on running, kind of thing.
Yes, that was the thing, wasn't it? So you could literally just run them off the board, couldn't you?
The cruel rule. Especially because I played guard at that time.
Yeah, that was quite funny. Because you could also, you could still do that with Space Marines as well.
Yeah.
You could still run a Space Marine off the board, which was quite hilarious. I think Space Marines, even as a part of They Shall Know No Fear, also got to try and rally before they went off the board edge as well. So I think when they hit the board edge, you could roll another morale test for them. But there you go. Fun times. A nice trip down memory lane there, Phil.
Yeah. I mean, I really enjoyed it. There's like a sort of huge section. Well, not a huge section. There's a couple of pages on how to convert up your models, which I think is quite inspiring. You don't quite see that in the current codexes, but you do see models that have been converted, I think, is the difference. But not necessarily that here's the tools you need to do it.
Given what you've read so far, has that affected the decisions of what you're going to add to your army for your Inquisition force?
Do you know what? No, because I think it's already confirmed what I want to do, and it's just given me a few like little story ideas to sort of stew in the back of my brain, because I sort of already knew the Inquisitor I was going to take, and I really wanted her to have a demon host. They were like my two main things that I'm planned on taking. I've still not really decided on henchmen in any way, so this book will be really handy for that, because it will give me a bit more guidance in terms of, I could take an astropath, but maybe it's not an astropath, maybe it's a ship navigator or a warp seer or a sanctioned cycle or something like that. So just that one page with a little bit of detail about the different types of henchmen, I think, is quite useful. Because there is no guidance in the current codexes. Here's a henchman, they've got the exact same loadout, and you can just give them different weapons. Whereas here, it actually gives each one a different purpose. So I think that will be quite helpful for sure.
Maybe next time you come around, Phil, I'll lend you the 5th edition Grey Knight book, which has rules for Inquisition in that as well.
Well, I also want the Witch Hunters, if you've got it still.
I do not have the Witch Hunters book.
No!
I know, I failed you on that front.
I might have the Witch Hunters book, actually.
Yeah.
I'm gonna mute my thing so I can rummage and thus not.
Well, Joe, I'd say we're probably about to wrap it up, my friend, so... We can leave that as a cliffhanger.
Maybe I'll add the rummaging noise to the podcast.
I mean, you're doing that pretty consistently. I mean, at some point you walked out the door and I heard that going off a minute ago.
I didn't walk out the door.
All right, then someone walked in the door.
You can't walk in a door.
Well, walk through the door.
It's super duper thin.
Anyway. Let's end it there, I reckon, guys. I think that's enough for today. As always, thank you very much, everyone, for supporting and listening to the podcast. Obviously, really appreciate it. Hopefully, you've enjoyed this collection of random instances underneath the banner of demons, assassins, and Inquisition in between, I suppose. But yeah, it's been cool to talk through all. As always, super appreciate you taking the time, gents, to sit here and talk through all this nonsense with myself. It's always fun.
Always a pleasure.
Absolutely. Any closing thoughts from anyone?
Oh, a big shout out to our regular listener Toke, who we talked about last week, because he sent me a few little bits for my models.
Really?
Yeah, I was after Well, I was chatting to him on Instagram because obviously that's where I spend all my time, and I needed a Ballgrin slab shield. Mm. And he was like, oh, I might have one of those. And then he was like, is there anything else you need? And I was like, I could do with some chainsaws, actually. So he sent me a bunch of those. And then he threw in a couple of little Nurglins, which is pretty cool. So thanks very much.
What a stand-up guy.
Yeah.
Yeah, appreciate the support, dude. And obviously, you know, thank you for supplying Phil with chainsaws. I'm sure he'll use them for something very exciting.
Oh, I will.
Oh, there you go. There you go. Joe, is there anything you want Toke to send you at this time?
I don't know. A good Warhammer book to listen to on Audible.
Right, so a digital... I love how...
I've got all the credits, so I can... I'm just looking for books to listen to.
Oh, I see. So you just want him to send you a recommendation for a book.
Yeah.
Anyway, there you go. So that has been episode 15 of the Lookout Sir 40K podcast. As always, we have thoroughly enjoyed talking about Warhammer 40,000. We do it all the time, so we try and document that and hope that you enjoy it as well. No idea what we'll be talking about next time. I believe it will be the last podcast before I go to the Warhammer Grand Tournament Finals, so I'll probably talk about the army list for that, though if you watch the finals of the LVO and the last game, the Elder army that guy's using is awfully similar to what I'm going to be using. But, you know, we'll see how that all works out.
We'll probably be talking about the new Black Legion stuff.
I hope so.
Because Tuesday is when it gets big reveal, which probably means that it'll go on pre-order the Saturday after, which means that we'll be doing this during the pre-order week.
Ooh, baby. Well, that's good. All right, brilliant. Well, there you go. This has been episode 15. Thank you very much, as always, and look forward to seeing you next time. Goodbye, everybody. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye-bye-bye. Bye. Joe's not saying goodbye.
Bye.
Bye. There you go, Joe. Never know why you never want to get involved in the byes.
That's because I'm knackered by this time.
It is true. It is now 9 minutes.